Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us this afternoon. Coming up on today's program, we're going to talk with Clay Turner, creative director for America's First Freedom, about his piece, Sheepdogs versus Terrorists. Also, Nick Adams, author of the new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, will join us on the program. You may remember Nick, one of our Australian friends who joins us from time to time here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Scott Bach, executive director of the Association of New Jersey and New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, on the anti-gun moves in the Garden State that are making it difficult even for retired police officers to exercise their Second Amendment rights. Now, if you're an anti-gun advocate, you don't think anybody should have a gun, right? Including former police officers. Certainly people who never were police officers don't deserve that right. Dean Reuter will join us in Hour 3 as well. He's one of the editors of the new book, Liberty's Nemesis, which is out by Encounter Books, or will soon be coming out by Encounter Books, a collection of essays on the executive overreach and the rather imperial nature of the presidency under the Obama administration. Author Kurt Schlichter will join us on the program as well. And I want to welcome to the program as we start out today's show our friend Jim Garrity from National Review. How are you, Jim?
Cam, good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. It seems like it has been forever. And I should let you know, I think I'll actually be up there next week. So hopefully we'll get a chance to see each other.
Looking forward to that. It will be our first post-Iowa, post-New Hampshire gathering. And the entire world will change completely once again. each contest, the entire Republican race completely turns upside down and is totally changed. And, you know, we throw out the old conventional wisdom and adopt new ones.
Yeah, I'm just sort of popping the popcorn and watching at this point, because I think that there is this is a year that is unlike a lot of other years before. And I'm not sure how well any of us are going to be able to predict what's going to happen on either side, quite frankly. And as a matter of fact, I want to start by talking about the Democratic primary, because the Des Moines mm-hmm. Register today coming out and saying, in essence, the Democratic Party needs to open the books on the Iowa caucus, because they're pretty convinced that Bernie Sanders actually won this thing.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that. This was actually posted around late last night, about 9:30. Now, Cam, you will know I am a non-Iowan. I am not for the raucous caucus. I actually am one of those guys who thinks any one of the 49 other states would do every bit as good a job, or maybe even a better job. I don't understand why all these guys out there in this state in the middle of the country get to eliminate like half the field because they go first, because they meet late at night in some January or February evening. Now, 4 years ago, the Republicans had a rather embarrassing scenario in which they announced on caucus night that Mitt Romney had won by 8 votes. A couple weeks later, they said, wait, we went back and double-checked. We're pretty sure Rick Santorum won by 36 votes, to which Rick Santorum is like, thanks, guys. Oh.
Yeah, we've still got you.
Okay. I heard a little beeping in the background. Yeah, so Rick Santorum's like, oh, well, great, thanks. You know, thanks for 3 weeks late declaring me the winner. And somewhere along the line in the process, they said, oh, by the way, we lost a box of votes, so we can't be 100% sure. That's really embarrassing, particularly if you're going to have big consequences of terms of levels of support and fundraising and media coverage and all that stuff is, you know, dependent upon this. So those of us outside Iowa grumble about it, but both parties decide to continue beginning with the Iowa caucus. Then this year, credit where it's due, Republican caucus got their act together. They used this new Microsoft system to tally the results, send them into a central location. Nobody got the blue screen of death. The little talking paperclip icon was very helpful. Bill Gates did not hack the election. Okay, somebody might be claiming Bill Gates hacked the election at this point. But as far as we know, everything worked out just fine. But on the Democratic side, one, they made the strange decision to not release the vote totals, which anytime you look at that, your antenna should be twitching a little bit. Like, wait a minute, wait mm-hmm. a minute. Why not? Why would you not share that? Why would that? And then, now this is genuinely in the rules, if it comes down to a tie, somewhere at the county level, not at the, you know, actual allocation of delegate level, They can resolve things by coin toss. One report that night said that there were, you know, that Hillary Clinton had gone 6 of 6. Boy, that people, you know, in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. There's a part of the play where, you know, one of the protagonists gets baffled by the fact he keeps flipping a coin and it comes up heads every single time. I'm starting to think, you know, Cam, they might be using the Harvey Dent coin from the Batman movies. That's actually two heads on both sides, and that explains why Hillary kept winning.
It's that old Clinton magic.
It actually turns out that Sanders had won 6 of the 7, and it's all perfectly normal and all that stuff. But look, you know, as the editorial puts it very clearly, too many accounts have arisen of inconsistent counts, untrained and overwhelmed volunteers, confused voters, cramped precinct locations, a lack of voter registration forms, and other problems. Too many of us, including members of the Register editorial board who are observing caucuses, saw opportunities for error amid Monday night's chaos. Now, if you're not particularly fond of the Democratic Party, Cam, get me some popcorn, too. I just want to see how this shakes out. Because you might argue that for Hillary Clinton, to win under highly contested and suspicious and dissatisfying circumstances, like that almost might be worse than a loss. Because now everybody in the Sanders team in the world, every Sanders supporter is like, hey, did we get cheated here? Did we get, you know, was the Iowa caucus stolen from us through some shenanigans?
Mm-hmm.
No, shenanigans sounds, by the way, like a Bernie Sanders word. I'm tired of these shenanigans.
No, everybody's tired of hearing about your election shenanigans. I agree with you, and I think it gives it's a cause to rally around for the Sandernistas. And you know, so we're going into New Hampshire right now. Bernie leading in the polls by anywhere from 14 to 22 points, thereabouts, right?
Yes, solid, outside the margin of error, fairly consistent across poll to poll.
So if Hillary were to all of a sudden pull within...
The argument that even I have been subscribing to for a long time have said, look, New Hampshire is a, it's a New England state. It's, you know, it's really close to, it's right next door to Vermont. It's the kind of state that, you know, a guy like Bernie Sanders should do well on. So Cam, where is Hillary Clinton from?
She's from America, Jim, right?
Yeah, you know, born in Illinois, spent a lot of years in Arkansas, but technically she's from New York. New York is not unbelievably far away from New Hampshire. Yes, you know, the state of Vermont is technically sticking in there in the way. Because somebody was saying to me, look, aren't New Hampshire and New York next to each other? And technically, no. I understand that New Hampshire and Vermont are easy to mix up there. But the idea being, like, this shouldn't be, and this also is a state that she won 8 years ago. So it's not like New Hampshire is this, like, you know, oh, strange alien country that you know, is hopelessly opposed to Hillary Clinton that she never had any chance of winning. You know, like, she should be able to do reasonably well there, and she's not. And some of this might be that his style just matches the state better, or it might be New Hampshire Democrats just don't really like the offering of Hillary and are excited by the Ben and Jerry's socialism flavor that Sanders is offering.
Well, I guess we will see on Tuesday. And meanwhile, you know, lurking in the background, Jim, paying very close attention to these results in Iowa, and he'll be watching very closely from high atop Grinch Mountain, Michael Bloomberg, who is, you know, debating about getting into the presidential race. Douglas Schoen has a piece of the Wall Street Journal today on why Bloomberg can win. That you know, there are these massive independents out there that aren't going to be happy with the Republican candidate. They're not going to be happy with the Democratic candidate, but they're going to love them some Michael Bloomberg. What do you think about this theory, Jim?
You know, look, it's one of those things where if I were advising Michael Bloomberg, I would ask for a lot of money. He's got it. If you were a political consultant and you didn't simply see Michael Bloomberg as a giant pile of money that you could suck up with a vacuum, you could look at him and say, look, if Hillary Clinton is – it's very hard to see a scenario in which Hillary Clinton does not come out of the FBI's investigation of her server without at least some headache. There are three scenarios that can happen. One is that it's unresolved. The Department of Justice tries to slow walk it and delay it and say, look, we can't reach a decision on this and try to kick the can down the road until after the election, at which point she's got this, like, cloud hanging over her all the way into November. They decide not to prosecute, and the rumors are the FBI director and lots of FBI senior staff might resign in protest if they feel like the politics are being influencing the investigation and the Department of Justice is averting its eyes from a violation of the law. Or, you know, one person at least been said to me through the grapevine, they think she'll get indicted and try to, you know, plead it down to some minor misdemeanor charge. In any of those scenarios, that's bad for her. You know, I actually think if she did, you know, if charges come, and I don't think it will, but if Attorney General Lynch ever did sign off on any charges against Hillary, that's effectively the end of her campaign. So then your next option, Bernie Sanders. You know, Larry David running around the country yelling at people and talking about a socialist revolution. That's not what Democrats expected to head into this cycle with. So if you're, you know, Michael Bloomberg, I mean, you and I think he's a nut job because we see him, you know, taking food from people's plates and banning large sodas and thinking nobody should have a gun except he and his personal security team and all of that. But by comparison, because he comes from a business background, people think of him as more moderate than he really is because he's technically an independent and not because he was technically a registered Republican for all those years. People think he's not that crazy and extreme. And I guess you could say a little bit of support for school choice here and there. But ultimately, he is the epitome of the ultimate urban progressive who doesn't understand how large chunks of the rest of the country live. So, but he can look at that and say, in a three-way race, I could have enough people who are frustrated with the Democrats and enough people frustrated with the Republicans that there might be a way to get a good chunk of the vote in the middle and see what happens. So if Michael Bloomberg has ever been thinking about being president of the United States, he'll probably never get a better opportunity than the 2016 cycle.
Yeah, okay. Here's the thing, though. I'm fairly convinced that if the people who are looking at the field, they're looking at the Democrats, and they look at the Republicans, they're not going to look at Michael Bloomberg and say, aha! I think they're likely to stay home. I think they're likely to not vote. Because what is it about Michael Bloomberg that would make them say, aha, now here's the guy I'm going to vote for?
If they can position him enough as this, aren't you tired of the two? Look, kind of what Trump was riding for a lot of this year, and certainly an element of Bernie Sanders support, which is, look, I'm not like those other guys. I'm an outsider. I've done things outside of the realm of politics. Now, if the day Michael Bloomberg shows up and says, I am not a politician, you and I will choke on something. Because we've been waiting, the three-term mayor of New York City who spends about $1 billion trying to influence everything from state legislative races to congressional races to senatorial races and has been pushing the anti-gun agenda since day one. This guy's not a politician. But for some reason, I think there's, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have been able to say, I'm not a politician, and had, some level of support this year. And, if it's a three-way race, all of a sudden having 35% might be enough.
All right. So it sounds like you think it's entirely plausible that Bloomberg does get in.
Yeah, I think it's also entirely plausible that he could look at what it would take to be president of the United States, to run for president. For 6 months of your life, constantly getting, every decision you've ever made run through second-guessed and analyzed and dissected, and the media, some media would be hostile, some media would be not so hostile. Does he want to spend the money? He'd have to self-finance. Does he have enough people to get on the ballot in all these different states? He might, 6 months of short jokes, does he want to go through with it? And then does he want to be president of the United States bad enough to deal with all that? Or does he want to just live the life of a billionaire in New York City for the rest of his life? And that's, he may very well decide, I'd rather live my happy life than deal with the grief and aggravation that comes along with, running for president.
Talking again with Jim Garrity from National Review. So let's say that things play out the way we expect them to. Bernie Sanders wins New Hampshire. Then things shift focus down south to South Carolina, where Hillary Clinton, at least in the polls right now, has a commanding lead over Bernie Sanders. Is that a state that we should watch? And also, Jim, I mean, how closely do you think we should be watching the overall turnout? You mentioned that the Democrats didn't reveal the number of total caucus goers, but I think the Des Moines Register estimated it to be 170,000 or so, which would have been fewer than the number of Republican caucus goers, which is surprising. We've seen polls. Ed Goas, I think, had a poll on voter enthusiasm, the intensity of the vote, much higher on the Republican side. Is this something that we should be paying attention to during the primaries, even the early primaries?
Yeah. Probably the first rattle in the engine for Republicans in the 2012 cycle was that a lot of Republicans, including myself, thought, look, oh, you know, we've had 4 years of Obama. He's been terrible. The economy still stinks. You know, the Tea Party has risen. People are really fired up. We should have really, you know, a big burst of energy on the Republican side. And turnout in 2012 was like a couple hundred votes more than it was in 2008. It was not actually significantly higher. And you could attribute that to the quality of the candidates of that cycle, but chances, it kind of indicated that actually, no, you weren't, this selection of candidates was not actually catching fire. It's a really good sign for Republicans that turnout is up from 4 years ago, at least in Iowa. And also, this is not all the Trump effect. If you take out all the Trump voters, they're still 15% higher than they were the previous high. In other words, this is the, I think it's safe to say that, yes, indisputably, Trump is bringing out certain people who might not have been interested in Republican politics 4 years ago, 8 years ago, or maybe even ever before. The flip side is I think he's bringing out people who don't like him and have decided to support against him. And that's that same thing that you point out with the possibility of a Bloomberg thing. You say, oh, some people will stay home. I think, if Michael Bloomberg runs third party, Cam, is it safe to assume that just about every last NRA member is going to get out there and vote for somebody? Just go out there and vote for somebody not named Michael Bloomberg at that point, you know. So I think this is a campaign that has had big, bold personalities, not afraid to say controversial things. And as a result of that, I think that drives support, and I think that also drives opposition. I think that, you know, Sanders is down in South Carolina pretty significantly. There's only been like two polls that have been occurred in January. So we don't have a ton of, we don't have a ton of data. And also, look, the near win in Iowa helps. If he wins in New Hampshire, you probably get a bunch of South Carolina Democrats to maybe give him a second look. Now, again, this is a state that doesn't have a ton of, South Carolina doesn't have a ton of Democrats, and the ones that are there are largely African-American. Maybe not the most natural demographic for Bernie Sanders to appeal to, but he certainly is going to try to make that pitch. And look, if Sanders really throttles her in New Hampshire, I think you'll see that the rumor is John Kerry is thinking about it, that Joe Biden is, you know, regretting his decision to not run. Every once in a while you still hear the name Al Gore being thrown around. If, as I mentioned earlier, but the problem with her, the potential indictment, if she is seen as a ticking time bomb, and Bernie Sanders is seen as this crazy old man yelling at clouds like Grandpa Simpson, then all of a sudden a lot of safe old retreads for the Democrats are going to think, I think I hear the party calling me. I think they need me to save them from this scenario. And, I mean, at that point, you know, Cam, we just got to put on more popcorn because it's just going to get better and better watching these guys fight with each other.
All right, listen, Jim, I appreciate you coming on the program. Sure, it is always a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we get a chance to do it in person next week.
Looking forward to seeing you, Cam. Take care.
All right, Jim Garrity joins from National Review here on NRA News, Cam and Company. And after a quick timeout, a court decision out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals today, and a good one, I think, for supporters of the right to keep and bear arms, a challenge to the Maryland Firearm Safety Act is going back down to the district court level after the Fourth Circuit said that the decision needed to be rendered under a strict scrutiny standard of review, as opposed to a broader standard in which more gun control laws could be upheld. We'll crunch the legal briefs here and give you some quotes from the Fourth Circuit after a quick timeout. So stick around. There's much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with with Juliana Crowder with a girl and a gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is a girl and a gun?
A girl and a gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club. But we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain body
types. A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about a girl and a gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year. Beginning the first Wednesday in March, we're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing, so somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right. So you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group, Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do, and thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one. Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Clay Turner from America's First Freedom going to join us in just a little bit. But the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals hearing a case, Colby versus Hogan, challenging aspects of the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, signed by Martin O'Malley, who was a guy running for president briefly, as Mr. Gun Control, by the way. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals coming out today with a decision that sends this case, which had been dismissed at the district court level, back down to district court with some instructions that the case be considered under strict scrutiny. And how the court gets here is really interesting. So you have a couple of individuals who own semi-automatic rifles that challenge this law.
on the prohibition of the manufacture, sale, possession of, quote-unquote, assault weapons and magazines over 10 rounds. So the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals says, all right, well, first we have to determine whether or not a Second Amendment challenge here is appropriate. Well, this is dealing with a case of owning firearms within the confines of your home for self-defense. The Heller case says that is the core purpose of the Second Amendment, is to have that individual right of self-defense, to both the keep and bear arms for that purpose. So, yes, there is a Second Amendment challenge that is applicable here. But we also need to determine whether or not the guns in question fall under protection of the Second Amendment. Are these guns dangerous or unusual items that could be prohibited by law? Or are these firearms that are in common use and are protected by the Second Amendment? They say, quote, like a number of courts that have previously considered this question, we have little difficulty in concluding that the banned semi-automatic rifles are in common use by law-abiding citizens. They quote Heller 2. They also quote Colorado Outfitters Association versus Hickenlooper out of Colorado. Shu versus Malloy, a challenge to Connecticut's gun control laws. The Fourth Circuit noted that that decision concluded that semi-automatic rifles such as the AR-15, as well as magazines with a capacity greater than 10 rounds, quote, are in common use within the meaning of Heller and presumably used for lawful purposes. They say we make the assessment based on the present-day use of these firearms nationwide. We think it is beyond dispute from the record before us, which contains much of the same evidence cited in the aforementioned decisions, that law-abiding citizens commonly possess semi-automatic rifles such as the AR-15. Between 1990 and 2012, more than 8 million AR and AK platform semi-automatic rifles alone were manufactured in or imported into the United States. In 2012, semi-automatic sporting rifles accounted for 20% of all retail firearm sales. For perspective, the court notes, in 2012, the number of AR and AK-style weapons manufactured and imported into the United States was more than double the number of Ford F-150 trucks sold, the most commonly sold vehicle in the United States. They say, likewise, the record in this case shows unequivocally that these firearms are commonly kept by American citizens. Magazines. Now we're over to magazines. That these, quote-unquote, large-capacity magazines are commonly kept by American citizens, as there are more than 75 million such magazines in circulation in the United States. In fact, these magazines are so common that they are standard, the Fourth Circuit noted. In addition, the Fourth Circuit said, we reject the state's argument that the Second Amendment does not apply to detachable magazines because magazines are not firearms. That is, detachable magazines do not constitute bearable arms that are expressly prohibited or protected, rather, by the Second Amendment. By Maryland's logic, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals writes, the government can circumvent the Heller decision, which established that the state cannot ban handguns kept in the home for self-defense, simply by prohibiting possession of individual components of a handgun, such as the firing pin. But, of course, the court says, without the ability to actually fire a gun, citizens cannot effectively exercise the right to bear arms. And they cite a case, Jackson versus the city of San Francisco, in which the court noted the Second Amendment protects arms, weapons, and firearms. It does not explicitly protect ammunition. Nevertheless, without bullets, the right to bear arms would be meaningless. In our view, the Fourth Circuit says, the right to possess firearms for protection implies a corresponding right to possess component parts necessary to make the firearms operable. This reasoning, the court says, applies to the magazines in question. To the extent that magazines, or to the extent that firearms equipped with detachable magazines are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes, there must also be an ancillary right to possess the magazines necessary to render those firearms operable. To the extent that the state can regulate those magazines, it is not because the magazines are not bearable arms within the meaning of the Second Amendment. So the court said, this case is challengeable. These arms are protected under the Second Amendment. These are firearms that are commonly owned. for lawful purposes. No, the state cannot simply ban magazines by saying that they are a component of a firearm. The state argues that the banned rifles are, quote, unusually dangerous and therefore do not fall within the purview of the Second Amendment. The court says Heller makes clear that dangerous and unusual weapons are not weapons typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes that have some degree of Second Amendment protection. But because all firearms are dangerous by definition, the state reasons that Heller must mean firearms that are unusually dangerous fall altogether outside of the scope of the Second Amendment. The state views the guns that they have banned, as well as large-capacity magazines, as, quote, unusually dangerous, rendering the Second Amendment inapplicable to the ban. The Fourth Circuit calls this argument by the state of Maryland novel. They say the state's novel, unusually dangerous standard reads too much into Heller. As best we can tell, no statute or case has mentioned, much less adopted, the state's newly proffered standard. They say in distinguishing between protected and unprotected weapons, Heller focused on whether the weapons were typically or commonly possessed, not whether they reached or exceeded some undefined level of dangerousness. Hand grenades, sawed-off shotguns, fully automatic M16 rifles, and the like are, quote, unusual weapons, according to Heller, that fall outside of the Second Amendment because they are not in common use or typically possessed by the citizenry. So they reject the idea that commonly owned semi-automatic firearms are dangerous and unusual. And they also said, furthermore, Heller refers to dangerous and unusual conjunctively, suggesting that even a dangerous weapon may enjoy constitutional protection if it is widely employed for lawful purposes, i.e. not unusual. So then the court says, well, now that we've considered this, and yes, this is a case that is challengeable on Second Amendment grounds, no, AR-15s and semi-automatic rifles are not dangerous or unusual. They're in common use. They are protected by the Second Amendment. Now we have to go back. We have to look at what level of scrutiny, judicial scrutiny, should be given to these gun laws, the Maryland Firearm Safety Act. The court, at the district court level, applied intermediate scrutiny. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals says, well, first we have to determine which of the two relevant standards, strict or intermediate scrutiny, actually apply to this case. And they say the strict scrutiny standard, the higher level of standard, requires that the government prove its restriction is, quote, narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling governmental interest. Narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. To be narrowly tailored, the court writes, the law must employ the least restrictive means to achieve the compelling government interest. That's under strict scrutiny. Under intermediate scrutiny, the government has to, quote, demonstrate that there is a reasonable fit between the challenged regulation and a substantial government objective. In other words, if you're looking at this under the intermediate level scrutiny, this is to make sure that, you know, there's some relationship there between the law in question and the stated objective by the government. In this case, gun control, public safety, reasonable fit. There's a lot of leeway. Under strict scrutiny, there's not a lot of leeway. Because you are, again, passing a law that directly affects the exercise of a constitutional right. So you have to make sure that the law that you're passing is the least burdensome to the exercise of individual rights as possible. And again, the interest of the government must be compelling. It can't be because we can. Oh, I think it's a good idea. We want to experiment. It needs to be, again, if you're talking about a gun control law, these particular firearms, we believe, are unduly dangerous, causing large amounts of violent crime. Therefore, by banning this class of firearms, we can make Maryland safer. The problem with that argument is that, again, these are firearms that aren't used in a lot of crimes. And the court, Fourth Circuit here, says the Maryland Firearm Safety Act's ban on semi-automatic rifles and larger capacity magazines burdens the availability and use of a class of arms for self-defense in the home, where the protection afforded by the Second Amendment is at its greatest. In other words, the Maryland Firearm Safety Act implicates the core of the Second Amendment. They say, second, we conclude that the challenged provisions of the Firearm Safety Act substantially burden this right. The burden imposed in this case is not merely incidental. Maryland law imposes a complete ban on the possession by law-abiding citizens of AR-15-style rifles, the most popular class of center-fire semi-automatic rifles in the United States. These are weapons that are protected under the Second Amendment. We therefore struggle, the court wrote, to see how Maryland's law would not substantially burden the core Second Amendment right to defend oneself and one's family in the home with a firearm that is commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens for such lawful purposes. Moreover, they say the FSA, Firearm Safety Act, also reaches every instance where an AR-15 platform or a larger capacity magazine might be preferable to handguns or bolt-action rifles. For example, hunting, recreational shooting, or competitive marksmanship events, all of which are lawful purposes protected by the Constitution. Thus, the court says, the Maryland Firearm Safety Act completely prohibits, not just regulates, an entire category of weaponry. As Judge Kavanaugh noted in dissent in the Heller 2 case, prohibiting this group of weapons might be the equivalent to a ban on a category of speech. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said, contrary to the district court's conclusion, the fact that handguns, bolt action, other manually loaded long guns, and as noted earlier, a few semi-automatic rifles are still available for self-defense does not mitigate this burden. In other words, the court can't ban an entire, the state can't ban an entire class of firearms and then say, well, it's not really a burden on the exercise of your Second Amendment rights because there are still some guns that we didn't ban. Fourth Circuit says, no. Indeed, the Supreme Court rejected essentially the same argument in Heller, that the District of Columbia's handgun ban did not unconstitutionally burden the right to self-defense because the law permitted the possession of long guns for home defense. In other words, you've tried this before. You tried this argument before, and it didn't work out. There are legitimate reasons, the Fourth Circuit said, for citizens to favor a semi-automatic rifle over handguns in defending themselves and their families at home. The record contains evidence suggesting that handguns are inherently less accurate than long guns. This might be an important consideration for a typical homeowner who, under the extreme duress of an armed and advancing attacker, is likely to fire but miss his or her target. The court says, in sum, for a law-abiding citizen who, for whatever reason, chooses to protect his home with a semi-automatic rifle instead of a semi-automatic handgun, or possesses a larger capacity magazine for use in firearms kept in the home, the Maryland Firearm Safety Act significantly burdens the exercise of the right to arm oneself at home. The court says the Firearm Safety Act restricts the right of Maryland citizens to select the means by which they defend their homes and their families. They say, we recognize that other courts have reached different outcomes when assessing similar bans, but we ultimately find these decisions unconvincing. Now, we'll talk more about this at the top of hour two. I know we've got to take a break. Clay Turner of America's First Freedom is going to join us. But we're going to revisit this case, Colby versus Hogan, at the top of hour two, because, again, the Fourth Circuit noting that, other circuits have disagreed with us. They've said that the bans like this are fine. We acknowledge that, but here's why we think they're wrong. We're going to get into the arguments about why the Fourth Circuit has split with some other circuits out there coming to the top of the hour. But after a quick timeout, Clay Turner, Creative Director for America's First Freedom, join us talking about his piece, Sheepdogs versus Terrorists. Stick around. There is much more. NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this quick timeout.
I'm speaking with Mark Velarde with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other, and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can't I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah. And all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it, and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up next hour, Nick Adams is going to join us. His new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Scott Bach, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. We're going to talk more about this decision out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Good news for the challenge to the Maryland Firearms Safety Act. And right now, I want to welcome to the program Creative Director for America's First Freedom Magazine, Clay Turner, joins us. Clay, how are you, sir?
I'm terrific, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And your piece, Terrorists versus Sheepdogs, published by America's First Freedom online earlier this week. I would encourage folks to read this if they haven't already. I know it's being shared far and wide, but you talk about the terror attacks that have been thwarted by law enforcement in this country, and unfortunately, those attacks that law enforcement could not stop, including a couple of instances of murderous men in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where you were from, right?
That's true. The Planned Parenthood attack happens about 3 miles from my house. I drive by that location weekly. Further beyond that, the Halloween attack that happened just earlier than that, 30 days prior to that, is about 5 miles from my home in Colorado Springs. So it's one thing to see these things happen on cable TV at faraway places in California or at on the East Coast, but then they happen right around the corner where you go by all the time and your friends are involved. Competitors that you shoot with on law enforcement are involved. Some of them may know the people who are wounded. You go to the funerals. It just brings an entirely new perspective to the whole question for you. All of a sudden, it's very personal.
And, again, this these crimes occur even as violent crime is becoming less common in the United States, but it certainly is not gone from American society. And you say the question here is how can we as individuals prepare for this threat when the threat is so random? Like, it'd be one thing, Clay, to say, all right, well, stay out of this bad neighborhood. And if you live in this bad neighborhood, hunker down, try to move. But as you say, when the nature of the threats seems so random, how do we as Americans respond?
And again, you're absolutely right. You watch what happened in San Bernardino, and you say, really, a holiday party for county employees has now become a target for terrorism? I remember very vividly my mother talking to her the day after 9/11. And she was very concerned. She was convinced that her building was next. I thought, Mom, really? Are you concerned about it? Yes, I'm afraid they're going to attack my building. She lived in a four-story home for assisted living for seniors in Colorado Springs. She couldn't have been further down the list. But she was convinced, that they were on the list. I think when you see the random nature of attacks that are going on, when marginalized individuals are looking for some place to make themselves known before they go out in a blaze of glory and looking for an excuse to perform some permission to perform some act like that, then it certainly makes sense to keep your eyes open and keep your head on a swivel at all times, even though the likelihood of it happening is less all the time. There's no connection between those two.
And you mentioned San Bernardino. We've talked with gun store owners in the area after the attack, and what they told us, Clay, is that they were seeing a huge turnout. People were coming in. They wanted to be able to get their firearm a lot of times for the very first time, but they were also asking about training. They wanted to try to get their concealed carry license. They were not interested in simply buying a gun and putting it up on a shelf somewhere. And this gets into that sheepdog mentality that you write about.
Well, I think that everybody that I talk to, I've noticed that more and more conversations I have, it used to be when I first began working, doing the magazine 15 years ago, I'd tell people what I did and they'd say, oh, really? NRA? Really? What's all that about? What's going on there? And you met some pushback sometimes. Now when I talk to people about it, they go, I just signed up for my concealed carry permit class. Or I just bought a firearm. I need to buy a firearm. I just signed up for more training. It's really there's been a sea change at the very grassroots level on how people think that they should prepare themselves for such an event, whether it's a terrorist attack or just, like I say in the article, your garden variety crime. There's a huge awareness of that, and you see it nationwide. You're right. Increasing number of background checks, increasing number of people in training, increasing number of concealed carry permits. I think people are very, very smart. They have a lot of common sense, and they're making those choices for themselves.
Absolutely. And you know, you've got a passage in your piece. You say, those who mock us for such preparations live in the luxury of a failure of imagination. They retreat to the safety of statistics that correctly show how unlikely we are to suffer such harm and cannot conceive that deadly danger could possibly be bothered to penetrate their cocoon of perceived safety. Their common refrain is that they've never felt threatened. They've never pausing to realize that there's no connection between feeling safe and being safe. As a last resort, you write, they veil their refusal to prepare with condescendence. I refuse to live my life in fear. When I read that passage, I immediately thought about a piece at CNN Money that ran earlier this week on how women are changing the gun industry. And the writer was clearly at the Shooting, Hunting, Outdoor trade show in Las Vegas. He was talking to a number of women who own their own business. These are small business owners. One of them talked about, starting her company after she was the victim of a sexual assault. Another was an OBGYN who carried a firearm for her personal safety because she got off work late at night and wanted to be able to protect herself when she walked to her car. And she designed a wrapping that you use as a holster. You know, these are people who, again, I'm sure anti-gun advocates would say, well, they're just paranoid, right? There's no reason for them to protect themselves. Or even if there is a reason for them, Clay, it doesn't apply to you, it doesn't apply to me. They are looking for a reason, as you say, to feel better about why they are not taking steps to protect themselves.
Well, they do, and that's just human nature. I mean, we all want to find some justification and some validation for the choices that we've made in life, whether it's, did we buy the right car? Did we have kids at the right age? Did I marry the right person? You're always looking for some positive reinforcement. The people who have not chosen to arm themselves or who this really just isn't on their radar screen, I've come to think that they are not wrong. They're just not there. There has been no event yet seminal enough in their lives to make them stop and think about it. It's got to get moved up on their priority list. They're busy doing other things like we all are. Nothing wrong with that. It's great that we live in a relatively safe society. The tragic part is sometimes those events that move that decision up on your priority list are life-changing. They're awful events. On the other end of the scale, sometimes you can see things on TV. Sometimes there's an event that happens 3 miles from your home that gets you to thinking, you know, maybe I need to examine this attitude a little bit more. Maybe I need to think about it. And that shows up in the way that you, the kind of conversations you have. I was talking with a female attorney a year ago in Denver. Very smart, very together woman, absolutely anti-gun. But when you talk to her about it, she'd say, are you carrying now? I'd say, yes. Really? Really? Are you? Come on. Really? Yes, I am. And that exchange right there shows that she has not even considered the possibility of it. It's just not on her radar screen. She doesn't have a reason not to. She just goes, come on. Really? Like common sense would just dictate that. She just hasn't thought about it long enough.
Well,
that makes sense.
Absolutely, it does. I think that, as you say, this is human nature. But this is also one of the reasons I think why gun owners typically are a very welcoming group, because they want people to just think about these things, even if it means that they don't end up parroting or agreeing with every position that that you hold. You at least want people to consider what it is that it means to protect yourself and those that you love. Listen, Clay, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, but I really do appreciate you coming on the program. It's fantastic talking to you today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. We'll do this again soon. Clay Turner joining us, the creative director for America's First Freedom. Again, go check out his piece, Sheepdogs, Terrorists versus Sheepdogs at America's First Freedom. Nick Adams, author of the new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness will join us on the program next hour. Also, Scott Bach, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. And coming up at the top of hour two, we're going to go back to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in Colby versus Hogan, handed down by the Fourth Circuit today. A great decision for gun owners, sending the case back down to the trial court with instructions to look at the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, the anti-gun bill signed into law by Governor then-Governor O'Malley back in 2013. Take a look at the laws banning, quote-unquote, assault weapons and large-capacity magazines with a view towards strict scrutiny. The court examined these gun control laws under intermediate scrutiny, and the Fourth Circuit said, no, that was wrong. These are laws that directly impact the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding Maryland residents, that means that you need to look at these laws through the highest level of scrutiny possible, which makes it, again, doesn't guarantee that the laws will be thrown out. But it does mean that these laws don't get a pass, which intermediate scrutiny oftentimes allows. Anyway, stick around. Hour two of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout.
With USA Shooting. Kevin, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm doing wonderful. It's an Olympic year, so a lot of excitement building.
Man, oh, man, there's a lot of excitement. So a lot of things to talk about. We want to talk about Rio, of course. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that. But first, you have a new campaign that you guys just launched. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the Shooting is My Olympic Sport campaign. So one of the things that we're trying to do is rally a community around the aspect of Olympic shooting. So not many people know that, you know, there's 15 Olympic disciplines, shooting events. And so what we're trying to do is gather everybody around this vast community that we have and really get them to rally around our Olympic shooting sports. So, you know, not many people may follow the Olympics. They, you know, they may know of gymnastics or track and field,
right, yeah.
But we're going to bring them to shooting. You know, we can all rally around that. So that's kind of what we're doing this year.
Awesome.
Going to have a lot of fun around it. So we developed this nice new logo. And just trying to bring everybody together around our cause.
I love it. So tell us about Rio. How's it looking?
Hey, we're looking good. We've got several world champions. Of course, we've got the return of, you know, Kim Rohde, a five-time Olympic medalist.
Great Kim Rohde. What a great ambassador for the shooting sport she is.
Yeah, she's
an ambassadress. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever the right word. She's awesome.
Yeah, whatever she is, she does it really well, so including shooting. So, you know, so she's got to make her spot still. That's how competitive our events are. Oftentimes, the hardest thing to do in the United States is make our own team.
Right. It's qualify, right?
Qualify.
Yeah.
Because there's that much depth. You know, Kim competes in skeet shooting. Well, we have a world champion in Morgan Kraft who's already earned her spot to Rio. So she beat out Kim.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
So there's two spots, and Kim's in the lead right now, and we'll find out in May if she makes the team, but she's looking pretty good right now.
I'll tell you what, Kevin, backstep a little bit with me here talking about Rio then. What are, because, you know, this is where sometimes it gets confusing even for me, what are the current the shooting events that are going to be in the Olympics?
Yeah, if you think it's confusing for you, what do you think I am? So I'm trying to explain it all. We got 15 Olympic events. We got five events in pistol, five events in shotgun, and five events in rifle.
So how does the U.S. Olympic Committee determine that, or how's it? Because didn't one of the events that Kim was in a few years ago got changed or worked in? I know they've changed the sports a lot.
Yeah, so the International Olympic Committee really kind of sets the table in terms of what Olympic events are in, and they're always looking at refactoring in a whole bunch of different things, whether it be gender equity or how well they play off on television
or whatever
it is. So they're always adding and subtracting events. So it's determined by the International Olympic Committee, and then they work with the International Federation for Shooting.
So now listen to that, folks. 15 shooting events in the Olympics. So shooting is not only my Olympic sport, but the Olympic sport. It's a big part of the Olympics. So it's important we all get to know about it.
Yeah, there's a couple facts there that are important. USA Shooting has won 107 Olympic medals all time. We've been in every Olympics since 1896.
Wow.
A lot of people wouldn't understand the success that we've had, but we're fourth most among all medals. So if you think of the big events, track and field, swimming, gymnastics,
right,
the things that we traditionally dominate in, we're fourth best among all sports in winning
That's
medals.
Awesome.
So we've got a great history of success.
We're there to take that ride with you guys here at NRA News. We love the stuff we do with you. Before we run out of time, Kevin, how can people get more information about USA Shooting, about this new campaign?
We got to go to the website, usashooting.org. You can also find us on social media at USA Shooting. Let's rally around this idea of shooting is my Olympic sport.
Welcome back. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. We'll talk with author Nick Adams about his new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Also, Scott Bach, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, join us later on in the hour as well. A story out of the Garden State, confusing New Jersey gun laws deny some ex-cops the right to carry. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get a concealed carry license under many circumstances in New Jersey. But being a former law enforcement officer might be one of the few ways that you can get a concealed carry license. But apparently that's not the case for all ex-officers in the Garden State. Now, we're also talking about this Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision out of Maryland, or challenging the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, in which the Fourth Circuit has said a number of very important things. First, yes, ARs, semi-automatic rifles, quote-unquote assault weapons, these are constitutionally protected firearms. In fact, the Fourth Circuit said there's really not much argument to be made otherwise. They are in common use by law-abiding Americans for a variety of lawful purposes, including self-defense inside the home. So, yes, these are constitutionally protected firearms. The argument by the state of Maryland that these were dangerous or unusual weapons, or dangerous and unusual weapons, holds no water whatsoever. That's a very important thing for the Fourth Circuit to say. Then the Fourth Circuit said the Maryland Firearm Safety Act needs to be looked at through the strict scrutiny lens, the highest level of scrutiny, judicial scrutiny that we apply. The burden is tough for the government, because we are talking about a law that, again, regulates, perhaps even infringes on an individual right that we as law-abiding Americans possess. Now, the Fourth Circuit said, we recognize that other courts have reached different outcomes when assessing similar bans, but we ultimately find those decisions unconvincing. And they lay out the reasoning why. They say the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, for instance, recently upheld a ban on quote-unquote assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. This was the case out of Illinois, challenging the ban in Highland Park, Illinois. The Fourth Circuit says the Seventh Circuit simply dispensed with levels of scrutiny entirely. Instead, they say that court conjured its own test, asking, quote, whether a regulation bans weapons that were common at the time of ratification, or those that have some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia, and whether law-abiding citizens retain adequate means of self-defense. The Fourth Circuit says the Seventh Circuit's approach cannot be reconciled with the Supreme Court's decision in Heller, which looked to present-day use to assess whether handguns are in common use and consequently protected. Seventh Circuit says this case, the Friedman case, problems stretch beyond its direct contradiction of Heller. For instance, the Friedman opinion defines the scope of the Second Amendment right by reference to militias, but it then declares that states which are in charge of militias should determine what weapons are rightfully held for militia-related purposes. The Fourth Circuit says that course effectively permits states to opt out of the Second Amendment. But see McDonald, in which the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment right is fully applicable to states. The Fourth Circuit says Friedman also concludes that the dangerousness of the regulated weapon should not be decisive, but nevertheless dismisses the self-defense-related benefits of those same weapons because, quote, they can fire more shots faster and thus can be more dangerous in aggregate. And it recognizes, the Fourth Circuit says, that the restriction must be supported by some genuine state interest, but then finds such an interest in the fact that bans might reduce the perceived risk of a mass shooting. In other words, the court says, under the Seventh Circuit's view, a significant restriction on a fundamental right might be justified by benefits that are quite literally imagined into existence. Needless to say, the Fourth Circuit says, we see much to question in the Seventh Circuit's decision. Ouch. This is what's known as setting up a split between the circuits. The Fourth Circuit says two courts of appeal have applied the standard of intermediate scrutiny to restrictions like Maryland's. Both did so, the Fourth Circuit says, after rather conclusorily determining that the bans in those cases did not impose any significant burden on the Second Amendment right. For its part, the D.C. Circuit was, quote, reasonably certain that the challenge laws didn't impose a substantial burden, while the Ninth Circuit found that the district court did not, quote, abuse its discretion at the preliminary injunction stage in finding much the same. The Fourth Circuit says whatever may be said about the bans at issue in those cases, it should be obvious by this point that we view Maryland's ban quite differently. A wholesale ban on an entire class of common firearms is much closer to the total handgun ban at issue in Heller than more incidental restrictions that might be properly subject to intermediate scrutiny. The court went on to say, the law here, quote, goes beyond mere regulation and is instead a, quote, total prohibition on possession of certain types of arms. So we're not talking about a law that nibbles around the edges here. They say such laws receive exceptionally rigorous review. Laws like the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, laws that directly go after the exercise of a right in a wholesale sweeping fashion. Such laws receive exceptionally rigorous review in the analogous context of the First Amendment, and we see no reason for a different method here. In other words, if we were talking about laws that were this sweeping when it pertained to speech or assembly or the exercise of religion, we would consider those laws through the lens of strict scrutiny. The government would have to meet the highest level of proof possible for us to determine that these laws were not a violation of their constitutional, of individuals' constitutional rights. That, again, this was a law that was tailored to a specific compelling argument by the government. This was the least amount that we could do, the law that has been designed to be razor thin here in its approach to go after a problem that is so compelling that the government has to act. That's the argument. That is the level of review that the court has said the state of Maryland must use to defend these laws. And it's the standard of review that the trial court must look at these laws. Under. They say our distinguished dissenting colleague asserts that we have imprudently and unnecessarily broken with our sister courts of appeal and infers that we will bear some responsibility for future mass shootings. This was the dissent in Colby versus Hogan now that the judges are writing about. In our view, the judges say, inferences of this nature have no place in judicial opinions, and we will not respond beyond noting this. The meaning of the Constitution does not depend on a popular vote of the circuits, and it is neither improper nor imprudent for us to disagree with other circuits addressing this issue. We are not a rubber stamp. We require strict scrutiny here, not because it aligns with our personal policy preferences, but because we believe that it is compelled by the law set out in Heller and Chester. Because the district court did not evaluate the challenge provisions of the Firearm Safety Act under the proper standard of strict scrutiny, and the state did not develop the evidence or arguments required to support the Firearm Safety Act under the proper standard. We vacate the district court's order as to the plaintiff's Second Amendment challenge and remand for the court to apply strict scrutiny in the first instance. This is not a finding, the court says, that Maryland's law is unconstitutional. It is simply a ruling that the test of its constitutionality is different from that used by the district court. The state should be afforded the opportunity to develop its case in light of this more demanding standard, and the plaintiff should be permitted to do so as well. So that's the order by the Fourth Circuit, again, sending this back down to trial court, but instructing the trial court that because of the issues at stake here, intermediate scrutiny, this level of judicial review that allows for a lot of anti-gun laws to stand, is not the proper lens through which the judge should view these laws. Again, as I said, a good decision by the Fourth Circuit today. And interesting as well that the Fourth Circuit going out of their way to note not just that they disagree with the Seventh Circuit decision, the case out of Highland Park, Illinois, again challenging the gun ban there, but why they disagree. Again, providing the documentary evidence that one would need to demonstrate to the Supreme Court that, look, we have a real split here in the circuit courts of appeals on this issue. There's been a lot of speculation as to why the Supreme Court hasn't taken up another Second Amendment case since McDonald. Well, one of the things that we know makes it more likely, not a guarantee, but it makes it more likely for the Supreme Court to step in and hear a case if there are splits at the courts of appeal level. If you have certain jurisdictions that have ruled one thing or one way, other jurisdictions that have ruled another, the Supreme Court steps in or is perhaps more likely to step in and issue a ruling that would settle the dispute within the circuits. And now we know that there is a clear and distinct difference between the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, for instance, and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And it is worth pointing out that the majority opinion refers to the dissent and does not dwell on the fact that the dissent in this Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion alleges that this decision will be responsible for more mass shootings within the Fourth Circuit. But instead notes that this was a, quote, imprudent and unnecessary breaking with the sister courts of appeal. In other words, everybody was playing along. Everybody had this language down. Everybody had figured out a way that that we could go ahead and uphold these bans. But no, you had to go and ruin things. You had to go and throw a wrench into the works here. In essence, is what the dissent in Colby versus Hogan telling the majority judges. And because of this, because of your actions here, because you've dissented, because you've actually presented an argument as to why the right to keep and own a semi-automatic rifle is no different than the right to keep and own a semi-automatic pistol or a revolver or a pump-action shotgun. Because you've pointed out the legal arguments as to why that's the case, you're going to be responsible if these laws ultimately get struck down. Again, that's in a legal opinion. That type of emotional vitriol. This was not a legal rationale, it sounds like, as much as it was a very emotional reaction. But the words of the court, I think are worth repeating. The meaning of the Constitution does not depend on a popular vote of the circuits, and it is neither improper nor imprudent for us to disagree with the other circuits addressing this issue. We are not a rubber stamp. Justice should be blind, right? Now, the judges certainly should be aware, and clearly they were aware of what other circuits were saying. And they can consider those arguments when crafting their own legal opinions, but if they genuinely disagree, if they can look to the Heller case, look to the McDonald case, and then say, you know, here's what we think the court's telling us to do. And it's not what they did over in the Seventh Circuit. In fact, we don't know what the hell they did over there. They just kind of made up their own standard. But here's what we think the court is telling us and other circuit courts around the country to do based on the language in the Heller and McDonald decisions. Well, here's what we're going to do. In essence, that is the blindness of justice. You're certainly aware of the precedent. You're aware of the what the court has said. But you are supposed to be blind to the considerations of going along to get along. And, you know, come on, everybody's pushing this anti-gun position. Why do we want to be the ones to rock the boat? That's Lady Justice flipping up her blindfold a little bit. Now, we will have to wait and see what will happen now that this case is going back to court. You know, the case originated, as I said, with the passage of the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, which was signed by Governor Martin O'Malley. Now, Martin O'Malley is no longer the governor of Maryland, no longer a candidate for president either. Governor Larry Hogan is the chief executive. It would be the Attorney General's office who would be in charge of defending the Maryland Firearm Safety Act. And as long as the law is on the books, I guess the state has to offer up or mount some sort of defense. Although I guess, actually, now that I think about it, the state, I guess, could decline to defend the law in court. That could be a possibility, I suppose, with the appeals process. But we'll have to wait and see what the parties decide to do here now that the Fourth Circuit has spoken. All right, stick around. When we come back after a quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company, the author of Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, our friend Nick Adams joins us. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Ruth Ann Sprague with NRA Foundation. Ruth Ann, tell folks, what is NRA Foundation? What do you guys do?
Well, the NRA Foundation is the 501c3 arm of the NRA. So we are there for charitable donations. We're involved in educational pursuits. But we are the part of the NRA. We can go out and raise money as a nonprofit, and a lot of that is done through friends of NRA. And then we can support the shooting sports or historical firearms, museums, things like that.
So you're here to support shooting sports and firearms museums and other things like that. And give us an idea of some of the groups that NRA Foundation supports.
Well, we support the NRA National Firearms Museum, but Boy Scout troops, a lot of youth groups. About 60% of our funding does go towards youth groups. We have supported historical firearms enactors, range improvements for nonprofit ranges, but those are the things that we can support.
So it's NRA Foundation. You raise your money a lot. You said friends of NRA and other ways. And then how can folks who are listening to this go, gosh, how can I get some of this money? What's the best way for them to get involved to find out? How do you guys disperse this?
Well, the best thing to do is to look at our website, nrafoundation.org, and the general public can see how they can contribute. Qualified groups can see how they can apply for a grant. There's a lot of great information at that website.
Great. And in about 20 seconds we have left, why is it important that NRA do this kind of work?
Wait, this is the shooting sports. This is the future. What we're doing is raising money now and then giving it to, especially to youth programs, so our youth can learn firearm safety, they can learn about hunters education, and we can carry the hunting tradition and shooting sports into the future.
speaking with Marianne Johnson with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Marianne, welcome back to NRA News. Tell folks, what is the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program?
So the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program is a firearm accident prevention education program for pre-K to fourth grade. It's all centered around Eddie's message, if you see a gun, stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up.
Why does NRA do this?
We do it as a way to keep kids safe, get kids thinking about guns. We understand that 47% of American households have firearms in them, so kids need to know what to do when they see them.
It kind of follows with the NRA's bedrock message of gun safety and how important it is.
Absolutely, and that's why we do what we can and try to prevent as many accidents as possible.
And how does the NRA do it? How does the program work?
So the program, we work mostly with schools, law enforcement, libraries, healthcare providers, and daycares. We provide them with all of the materials that they need to run the program, including instructor guides, animated DVD, workbooks, stickers, and parents' guides for the kids to take home. So it's very easy to use, very accessible, and we're also able to offer all the material for free thanks to grant funding from the Friends of the NRA.
And there's that cool costume you might be able to get to bring to your school, right?
Absolutely, yes. We do have the mascot costume, which we're currently in the process of updating to go along with our new look that we have. And law enforcement agencies across the country all have costumes and add a whole new element to the presentation. We have a brand new website just for kids. It's eddieeagle.com. It has the video on it, has the Eddie Eagle challenge that kids can take, as well as coloring pages and some sing-along songs as well.
And Marianne, how do people get more information about the program?
The best way is either you can look us up online, eddieeagle.nra.org, or you can send us an email at eddie@nrahq.org.
Marianne Johnson, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program, Scott Bach, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, should be chatting with Mr. Nick Adams about his new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, here before long. The Washington Post reporting, appeals court decision casts doubt on Maryland's, quote-unquote, assault weapons ban. A Post says, in its majority opinion written by Chief Judge William B. Traxler, Jr., the court found that the Maryland law, quote, significantly burdens the exercise of the right to arm oneself at home. The Post says, in a strongly worded dissent, Judge Robert B. King wrote, let's be real. The assault weapons banned by Maryland's law are exceptionally lethal weapons of war and are not, he said, constitutionally protected. Let's be real for a second. The firearms that are banned in the Maryland Firearm Safety Act are not exceptionally lethal weapons of war. They are semi-automatic firearms. As the majority opinion pointed out, 20% of all retail firearm sales over the last few years. Now, we were recently in Baltimore, Maryland. And we were at the AdCorps defense facility. We were there with Medal of Honor recipient Clinton Romache, who is now a civilian. And the type of firearm that he owns as a civilian is a little different than the rifle that he carried in the U.S. Army. And the firearms that AdCorps makes for the military, a little bit different than the civilian market. We don't want to send our soldiers off to war to fight with semi-automatic rifles. We like them more than that. So let's be real here. The guns that are banned under the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, as the Fourth Circuit majority opinion noted, are commonly owned by law-abiding Americans for any number of lawful purposes, including, as the court said, self-defense in the home. The Washington Post talks about, again, the Fourth Circuit demanding that the U.S. District Court apply a more stringent standard of review to the case. They say U.S. District Judge Catherine Blake in Baltimore had found that the Maryland Firearm Safety Act serves the government's public safety interest without imposing an undue burden on law-abiding gun owners. The Post also notes that Maryland's Attorney General Brian Frosch helped pass the law as a state senator. He says that the majority opinion got it wrong. He said, quote, I think it's just common sense that the Second Amendment does not give people the right to own military-style assault weapons. He said he would either ask for an en banc review by the entire Fourth Circuit or seek review from the U.S. Supreme Court. Quote, I think it's just common sense that the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Maryland's Attorney General thinks it's just common sense that the Second Amendment doesn't give people the right to own semi-automatic rifles. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. I'd love to know how he sees a quote-unquote common-sense gun ban in that language. Now, one welcome to the program right now, the author of the new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, Nick Adams joins us. Nick, how you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I am good. It's been a while, but I understand you've been busy writing a book and all.
Well, look, it's always a pleasure to be with you, and it's great to speak to your audience, which is full of patriotic, fabulous Americans that embody American exceptionalism.
Well, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. So tell us about the new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. I should mention up front, I did have an opportunity to take a sneak peek at your book. You were kind enough to ask me to blurb the book, and I was happy to do so. But what is this book all about, Nick?
Well, this is a book for anybody that loves America and hates political correctness. This is a book that says every single problem in America today is related to political correctness. Whether it is open borders, the police not being able to do their job, declining educational standards, receding Christianity, diminished America on the world stage, gun control ambitions, burgeoning government size, unsustainable federal debt, I could go on and on as I do in the book, but every single issue that is making America weak right now and not letting America be America is political correctness. And that's why I believe Americans have got to step up and crush it, because the rest of the world's too far gone. The rest of the world's been ravaged by it. You guys are currently in the process of being ravaged by it, but you can crush it because you guys are patriots and you're different to everyone else.
So how do you define political correctness? And do you get into the challenge, Nick, of, you know, look, in a free society, we believe in the freedom of speech, right? We believe that people should have the right to express opinions, both popular and unpopular. In other words, those who believe in a free society believe that those who want to be politically correct should have the freedom to do so. But we also want to reserve our freedom to say, nah, you be you and I'm going to be me, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Look, political correctness is all about forcing conformity and bullying people into silence. There are three things, Cam, that America is famous for: individualism, confidence, and identity. And what political correctness tries to do is remove each of those three qualities. They don't want people to have an identity. They want everyone to think that everyone's the same and that all cultures are equal, all countries are no better or different than anywhere else. They want people to be part of the collective. They don't want people who don't conform. They don't want people who are going to question the status quo. They don't want people who are going to be bold and outspoken. And third of all, they want to remove our individuality. I mean, they want to make everyone the same. They want everyone just to be plain. And there is a new gospel in town. It's the Green Gay Gospel. If you have a look at the two key issues by which political correctness goes by, it's usually a belief in climate change and a belief in gay marriage. They're the two standard tests. And, you know, if you happen to blaspheme against this new green gay gospel, God help you. I mean, conservatives and everyday Americans have become the new communists. Before it used to be, Cam, that if you were a communist or had an association with a communist, that would mean that you couldn't get a job, that you'd miss out on opportunities. Now, it's exactly the opposite. We see speakers being cancelled on college campuses. We see people losing their jobs for making a political donation. And it's got to stop. This is totally un-American. There's nothing more anti-American, un-American than political correctness. And I think people are just sick and tired of all of the nonsense of being attacked for trigger warning and microaggressing and macroaggressing and white privileging and not knowing the 57 different genders and being accused of being a racist if they criticize President Obama.
I think you're right, Nick, and I think that we're starting to see some of the pushback occur on college campuses, ironically enough. Because, you know, we've started to see the revolution start to eat itself, right? People going after people with whom they agree with 99.9% of the time, but they use the wrong word. They expressed an unapproved thought. And so they must be brought back into line. Like someone like yourself, probably someone like me, we're considered so far gone. There's no point in going after us, Nick, right? I mean, unless you want to build us up a straw man and try to attack us that way. But they're not going to try to convince you that they're right. They're not going to try to convince you to be like them. You're a lost cause in that regard. But we do see it on college campuses where whether students or faculty are sort of again, through accusations of things like microaggression, these students or faculty are I think, bullied into falling in line, right? And don't disagree with this. Don't express a contrary point of view. Don't think that you are an individual. Here's how you should think. It's not about intellectual curiosity anymore. It's about intellectual conformity.
That's absolutely 100% accurate, Cam, and I talk about this in my book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, how, you know, you're right. I mean, the one thing that the left has always understood much better than us is that in order to be able to control tomorrow, you've got to be able to control the children of today, because the students of today are going to be tomorrow's entrepreneurs, innovators, and stewards of the United States of America and therefore the world. And so they have made a concerted effort. And that's why there is no greater moral imperative, I believe, as I point out in my book, than recapturing the classrooms and the lecture theaters of high schools and universities right across America. Because unless we can do that, and unless we can steal back these, I mean, we're seeing, Cam, what these millennials are doing to America. They have been so brainwashed, so indoctrinated, so to believe that they've got to inculcate victimhood, that right now America is suffering as a result. I mean, the political gravity is far more to the left than it has ever been. And it's precisely because of millennials and this successful leftist takeover of high schools and universities in the last 30 to 40 to 50 years.
Talking again with Nick Adams, his new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Nick, we're almost out of time, but when does the book come out, or is it out now?
The book comes out in a couple of weeks, but right now, Cam, you can go online, you can go to Amazon, and you can pre-order it. That's what lots of people have been doing. It's really catching fire. It's a terrific read. It's a how-to. And like I said at the outset, if you love America and you hate political correctness, you've got to read this book, because this book will teach you how to crush this totalitarian thug of an ideology.
Well, listen, buddy, I appreciate you coming on the program, and I know how important the pre-orders are for those first week sales. Someone had a book come out a few months ago. So head over to Amazon, check it out, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Nick Adams, thank you so much for your time, sir, and hope we can do this again soon.
Love you, my friend. Let's do it in a couple of weeks.
All right, we'll talk. All right, we'll talk when the book comes out. Nick Adams with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Scott Bach is going to join us in just a little bit. Coming up top of the hour, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. I've been taking a look at the dissent in this Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. The judge who says, let's be real, these semi-automatic rifles, these are modern battlefield weapons of war. There's no way they're covered under the Second Amendment. They should be banned. He offers up several rationales here, starting with this one. He says that the banned assault weapons are not constitutionally protected, finds considerable support in the record, which includes the following evidence. The AR-15 and other banned assault weapons, like their military counterparts, are, quote, firearms designed for the battlefield, for the soldier to be able to shoot a large number of rounds across a battlefield at a high rate of speed. The military-style features of those weapons, the judge said, includes folding or telescoping stocks, pistol grips, flash suppressors, grenade launchers, night sights, and the ability to accept detachable magazines and bayonets. Their design results in a, quote, capability for lethality, more wounds, more serious, and more victims, far beyond that of other firearms in general, including other semi-automatic guns. Well, that's a lot to unpack. All right, so let's see. First of all, the semi-automatic firearms that are banned under the Maryland Firearms Safety Act are not firearms designed for the battlefield, for the soldier to be able to shoot a large number of rounds across the battlefield at a high rate of speed. They function like virtually every other firearm sold here in the United States, where one pull of the trigger means one bullet comes out the end of the barrel. Unlike the firearms that actually are used on the battlefield, which have select fire capability, meaning one pull of the trigger can either release a burst of ammunition or a steady stream of ammunition as long as your finger is still on the trigger. In other words, they function very differently. Now, let's see. Folding or telescoping stocks, pistol grips, flash suppressors, grenade launchers, night sights, and the ability to accept detachable magazines and bayonets. You know, even the muskets around that the American Revolution could accept bayonets, right? They didn't have grenade launchers back then. If they had had folding or telescoping stocks, I imagine that they would have used those. This is like the laundry list of things that, again, are different on an AR than on a traditional wooden hunting rifle. Yes, you might have a folding or a telescoping stock. Why is that important? Well, for instance, when my wife and I shoot our AR, we're different. I'm actually a little bit shorter than my wife, so I like to move the stock in a little bit so it's more comfortable for me to shoot. She likes to move it out a little bit so it's more comfortable for her to shoot. Does that make it any more dangerous, any more lethal? Of course not. And again, if you know something about firearms, then you understand that. If you don't, if you're reading on the anti-gun literature, I still don't see how that could freak you out, but I suppose we've seen the evidence that it can, in fact, do so. The dissenting judge in this Fourth Circuit case said the sole difference between the M16 and the AR-15 is that the M16 is capable of automatic fire while the AR-15 is semi-automatic. That difference is slight. Really? It's slight. Huh. Not so slight, by the way, that the law doesn't see it as a serious difference. The judge says the automatic firing of all the ammunition in a 30-round magazine takes 2 seconds, whereas a semi-automatic rifle can empty the same magazine in about 5 seconds. The judge says the banned assault rifles and shotguns constitute no more than 3% of the civilian gun stock, and ownership of such weapons is concentrated in less than 1% of the U.S. population. I'm not sure how he gets that number. That just says, at the same time, assault weapons are used disproportionately to their ownership in mass shootings and the murders of police officers, and they cause more fatalities and injuries than other firearms. Well, that's just wrong. You know, this is why back in the late 1960s, gun control advocates didn't start by trying to ban rifles, even though the AR-15 was already on the market in the late 1960s. They tried to ban handguns. Why? Because handguns are used more often in violent crimes. Now, the Supreme Court has said you can't ban an entire class of firearms like handguns. Said that in the Heller decision. Striking down D.C.'s gun ban that had been in place since the 1970s. But this is just, this is, as a judicial opinion goes, there's no citation for that statement, and I'm guessing because he couldn't come up with one. I'm not an attorney. I don't even pretend to play one on TV. But I'm reasonably certain that I could write a more judicial opinion than this one. All right, we got to take a time out. When we return to the program, Scott Bock's going to join us, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. Stick around. We will be back with more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm here with my good friend Bruce Pyatt, competitive shooter. Bruce, okay, I have to do this interview and introduce you. So what do I say? Okay, here, look at this. Bruce, what haven't you done? NRA 2015 World Shooting Championship winner, five-time Bianchi Cup, NRA Action Pistol. I don't know. How do I introduce Bruce Pyatt?
Well, for 30 years I've been a police officer. I just retired. And the whole time I've been a competitive shooter. I started when I was a kid. And so I guess I'm...
You're Bruce Pyatt.
I guess.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Pyatt. What do I need to say? It's been quite a year for you and continues to be. We're going to talk a little bit about what you've done and what you have coming up. And first of all, let's step back. You said you're a police officer, just retired, and thank you for your service as a police officer. How did you go get into competitive shooting from being a police officer?
Well, actually, I was a competitive shooter before being a police officer.
Okay. Right? So how did that happen?
I started when I was a little kid, just shooting. I was bugging my dad to take me hunting. So what he did is signed me up for NRA small bore 50-foot at a local indoor range.
Good for him, because look what he did. He got you out of his hair, and look what he did for you.
Yeah. Well, I grew up right outside of New York City in New Jersey. There isn't places to shoot, so I had to start indoors. And as soon as the junior program's done, men would come in and shoot bullseye pistol. Well, all the kids would go home, and I'd be standing there at the window watching the men, and I wanted to shoot pistol so bad. You know, let me get in there, and sure enough, some of the men would let me come in and fire a few shots. And
that's cool.
Well, as soon as I could get my hands on a pistol, I was doing it. We had some family heirlooms, you know, from my grandfather. My grandfather had a bunch of guns. He was actually an active shooter. So as soon as I could get my hands on pistols, I was doing it.
And look at Bruce, how natural the mentoring process is. Even these are guys who weren't, or you know, their guys are in there shooting. They saw you had interest. They took you in and showed you how to do it. And dude, they lit that fire. That is so great. All right, so the 2015 NRA World Shooting Championship winner. That was an interesting competition. That was something new, right?
It was. this is the second year they had it. It's a very interesting format that they supply all the guns, they supply all the ammo, and it's 12 or 13 different disciplines. We shot everything from cowboy action to precision 22 rimfire, all the way up to long range.
So it really
high power, everything.
And nothing against three gun, Bruce, but unlike three gun, this really was just the gamut of disciplines.
Every discipline, bullseye, handgun, everything. Yeah. You couldn't be good at one thing and win there. You had to be good at everything. We had aerial shotgun, you know, trap ski, everything.
I'll tell you, and I was talking to some of the competitors out there, and they had to keep the right attitude because there's some competitors who are really, really good at doing certain things, and they came in and it's like, I can't do this very well. But if you let yourself kind of get caught up in that, it's going to tear you down at a thing like that.
That's exactly true. The guys that were good at IPSC or whatever their specialty was, they would push hard at that specialty and thinking that's going to help them along in the whole competition. And that really is not the case. You had to be steady and stable the whole way through. You couldn't crash anything.
And stay with it. Speaking of Bruce Pyatt, all right, Bruce. So, okay, moving on. 2016, what you got a lot coming up. Once again, here's the schedule of stuff. And this is just a sampling, ladies and gentlemen, what's coming up for Bruce Pyatt.
There's more.
There's more. What are you looking forward to the most?
Actually, shooting-wise, in November, the World Bianchi Cup match is down in New Zealand.
Oh, nice.
Shooting is shooting. I like shooting anything. But to go down to New Zealand, it's a beautiful place. I've been there twice.
Would you like me to come and cover it for NRA News Camera Company?
I got a bag. You can carry my bag.
There you go. Boys, we're going to New Zealand. I always wanted to go to New
Take
Zealand.
Take the whole crew.
I'm going to say Bruce Pyatt told me to come to New Zealand. All right. So that comes, that kind of stuff like that keeps the fire going, I imagine. Keeps you into it, interested.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate my whole career. Police paid my bills. And my sponsors have basically paid for my hobby.
Mention a few of those
life.
Sponsors.
Caspian Arms, I've been with them my whole shooting career. 29 years I've been with them.
Wow.
Sierra Bullets, Starline Brass, almost the same time. DPMS, Panther Arms.
Cool.
Burris Optics and H&M Black Nitride. I just came out with them. So
beautiful. All right, before we run out of time, how can we get more information about Bruce Pyatt?
My website, brucepyatt.com.
BrucePyatt.com. Bruce Pyatt, what a guy. You're a great guy, and you're a great mentor. We love what you do, and we love having you here on NRA News.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. We've got the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day coming up top of the hour. Also, Dean Reuter, author of the new book, Liberty's Nemesis. In studio, Kurt Schlichter coming up in hour three as well. And right now, I want to welcome the executive director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, Mr. Scott Bach, is with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. How you doing, Scott?
Hey, Cam. Great to be back.
Good to be back talking to you as well. Although, again, it's New Jersey here, so it's your typical New Jersey story. It always amazes me that New Jersey can find some new way to mess with people's rights, but NJ.com. Talking about the confusing New Jersey gun laws that are denying some ex-cops the right to carry. Now, in New Jersey, Scott, permits are concealed carry permits are a discretionary issue, right? You can be denied for any reason or no reason whatsoever.
Well, correct. It's worse than that. You have to prove something called justifiable need, which has been defined to mean you have to prove, you have to give evidence of prior attacks or actual threats. So it's worse than any reason or no reason. The standard is so high, most people can't meet it.
Okay, but the New Jersey statute also does say that retired police are eligible, right, as long as they are federal, state, county, or municipal officers, sheriff's officers, corrections officers, park police, and county prosecutor investigators. It also specifically includes, according to NJ.com, any former, quote, full-time member of a state law enforcement agency. But there was a former officer, John Kuchkowski, who was a university hospital police officer, who went on to become a highly decorated university medicine and dentistry of New Jersey police sergeant. But he retired in 2011, and he was told, meh, not the right kind of law enforcement officer to qualify.
Well, I mean, is it any surprise that New Jersey's gun laws have been written so restrictively? You know, the folks writing these are so afraid that somehow the wrong kind of cop could wind up with a carry permit that, you know, the law's been written in such a way that it's not comprehensive. You know, you have the same mismanagement of public policy that applies to civilians, in this case, has also applied to law enforcement. And it's an important lesson for everyone. You know, oftentimes the anti-gun lawmakers in the state try to divide and conquer, you know, between law enforcement and civilians. You know, they, like in the smart gun law, which exempted police from its ban on conventional handguns,
mm-hmm.
and you know to try to drive a wedge between police and civilians. But here, you have the exact same phenomenon, you know, that's affecting law enforcement, and it really isn't a surprise, and it should be a wake-up call to law enforcement not to fall for that kind of a divide-and-conquer strategy, because quite honestly, the anti-gun folks in New Jersey nearly tolerate law enforcement having carry permits when they retire. It's something they do reluctantly, and it's something they would love to restrict further, Cam.
Absolutely. And this, I think, should be a cautionary note for gun owners around the country as well, that, you know, when push comes to shove, these quote-unquote gun safety advocates are really opposed to the idea of anybody carrying a firearm for self-defense. It doesn't matter what your background is, doesn't matter what the law of the land is, doesn't matter what the Second Amendment says. They are opposed to this. Now, I did think there was something fascinating kind of buried in this story, Scott. The line, quote, ironic, too, is that New Jersey university officers often have more crime experience than small-town cops or park police. Sergeant Kachowski and a colleague of his, who's also challenging his denial of a concealed carry license, both said that they worked there at the university because of the action. And NJ.com says anyone familiar with UMDNJ knows campus police there aren't security guards who carry nightsticks in some bucolic college setting. University Hospital is the gunshot wound capital of New Jersey. Rolling through the emergency room doors with those gunshot wounds is a cauldron of emotional craziness from angry friends and family of the injured to killers looking to finish the job. You've got housing projects that were located nearby that these officers had to go and chase armed robbery suspects into at points in their career. Fascinating, Scott, because we keep hearing all this talk about how campuses are perfectly safe and crime-free, and here you've got this acknowledgement that in New Jersey, college campuses, universities are actually crime hotbeds. They see more action, cops on some of these campuses, than small-town police officers do.
Well, Cam, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It is a cautionary tale. This isn't about safety. It's not about gun violence. You know, those who want to stop gun violence, if you just substitute the word gun ownership for gun violence, that tells the whole story. And it applies to law enforcement, too. And it applies to our military, who outrageously have been disarmed in all these settings where they're turned into basically, you know, moving targets. It's absurd. New Jersey's carry laws are unconstitutional. We are anticipating a small incremental improvement in those laws coming out of the executive branch of government. But nonetheless, we have a long way to go in the Garden State. The Garden State itself is a cautionary tale, Cam. You know, for those who think, you know, who are in pro-gun places, who think, well, it can't happen here. Well, you know, 40, 50 years ago, New Jersey was a lot more free than it is now. And, you know, those of you in strongholds for the Second Amendment, you need to hold your ground so you don't become like New Jersey.
Scott Bach, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. I appreciate you coming on the program, Scott. Hope we can do this again soon.
Thanks, Cam.
You bet. Scott Bach with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. By the way, it's not just campuses in New Jersey that are dangerous places. MLive.com, bats, guns used in armed robbery near Eastern Michigan University's campus. Armed robbery and home invasion right off campus. Georgia State is now offering a $2,000 reward for any information that leads to an arrest and a string of robberies in the campus library over the past 2 weeks. They made one arrest, but the robberies didn't stop. At last report, Georgia State had actually closed the campus library. They're talking about beefing up a security there in the library. There also were some students there at Georgia State who would like you to know that just because people are being robbed at gunpoint there in the library doesn't mean that they think that campus carry has any place there on campus. My San Antonio reporting two sexual assaults reported at Texas State University. An off-campus convenience store employee shot and killed right off campus outside the University of Louisville. A fifth suspect. That's in a different crime there, unfortunately. So, no, we don't have a suspect in that shooting near the University of Louisville campus. In Durham, deputies recently foiled a robbery right near the Duke campus. Northwestern University students robbed at their home near the Evanston campus. Again, these aren't areas that are untouched by crime. Crime occurs on and near our college campuses all the time. And again, a little bit of acknowledgement of that in the NJ.com story about these police officers who thought they would be able to get their concealed carry license once they retired, but we're told again they're the wrong type of police officer. They were university police, even though they had been detailed to the Newark Police Department on assignment on several occasions. Still not the the right type of cop. You know, again, if New Jersey simply had shall issue concealed carry laws on the books where you met the statutory requirements, it wouldn't matter what kind of cop you were. Matter of fact, you wouldn't even have to be a cop. You could be a grown man or woman living in Newark, New Jersey, and you could get your concealed carry license. And you could defend yourself against those who would try to rob you, those who would break into your home knowing that you were defenseless. Because New Jersey has really restrictive gun control laws that the law-abiding obey, but the lawbreakers do not. But instead, the anti-gun lawmakers in New Jersey still pushing things like this quote-unquote smart gun legislation that would require gun store owners to sell smart guns, have them there in stock on their shelves for any potential customers, while ignoring the fact that the laws in New Jersey are designed to prevent as many people as possible from ever walking out of a gun store as the legal owner of a firearm. Smart gun, dumb gun, whatever kind of firearm. The laws in New Jersey were built to block the exercise, to discourage the exercise of your right to keep and bear arms. All right, stick around. Hour three of NRA News Cam and Company is on the way with the hero of the day, the deal of the day, good guy of the day, and so much more. We'll be back right after this with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Command Sergeant Major Patrick Valdez, he's retired, and he's now with Freedom Hunters. Patrick, thank you so much for being here, and we'll go right to the shot of what you tell us what you do, because this makes a very big impression when you wield this up to the set here. Tell us what's Freedom Hunters all about, and tell us about the chair.
Freedom Hunters, we're a nonprofit. We take all veterans, all wars, all branches, and outdoor shooting activities, to include hunting, target shooting, trap, long range, whatever we can get the guy out. It started out with the Wounded Warrior Program at Fort Carson, Colorado, and to get guys out of the barracks, kind of like what Healing Waters did. It's hunting and getting guys outdoors. When you get back from a combat environment, you want to go back and do the things you did before. You want peace, you want calm, you want quiet. And getting guys outdoors and gals is our primary mission.
So tell us about the chair you brought along.
The chair is an amazing device. It's the Action Track Chair. It's an American-made. It runs 5 miles an hour. We can get guys, and I say guys being guys and gals, into places they can't get with a normal wheelchair. Little skinny tires get stuck in the mud, stuck in the sand. We put them in this, and we can get them right to a blind. We can get them to a duck or a goose blind. We've taken them elk hunting, mule deer out west. We've even taken them fly fishing. With it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it can go into a little bit of water, not a lot.
Awesome.
But it is battery operated. And it's just a great tool to get guys out. And it gives them independence. It gets a guy that's in a chair the freedom to get off the concrete and get into the snow, sand, dirt, whatever. And not have to worry about getting stuck.
So why did you do this?
You know, I started out as a patient in the program. I got injured in Iraq in February of 2007. And Freedom Hunters came to me and said, when they were really small, they said, we heard you want to go do something different. And I'd never been waterfowl hunting, so they took me, and that's how I started with them. So I was initially a patient in the program.
Cool.
Then I became a mentor. Now that I'm retired and have a little more time on my hands, I work as an outreach coordinator helping the guys out.
That's awesome. Talking with Patrick Valdez with Freedom Hunters. So, Patrick, I was out at Camp Perry one time at the Nationals there, and I know exactly what you're talking about. There was another organization who worked with wounded vets, and they got them out hunting and shooting. Those guys just, you know, it's what they grew up doing. It's why a lot of them got into the service to begin with, and they're just so happy just to be getting out there again and just being out with the guys. It's hugely impactful to them.
Well, it's an independence issue. You know, when they get back, they're well medicated, they're being taken care of, they have all of these appointments, and then they're like, I just want to go be by myself or get back into the wild. And especially at Camp Perry, it's a little sandy there.
Yeah.
And I've seen what wheelchairs do there, and they sink. And then all their buddies, usually four of them, drag them to the firing line. And I've been on hunts where we didn't have a track chair available, and we had to drag the guy in his chair up to a blind.
Yeah. So something like that chair can't be cheap. So tell me, I'm obvious you guys probably need support. So we've got about 30 seconds left here. Tell us about Freedom Hunters. How can people get involved? How can they help out?
Freedomhunters.org, first of all. Come to our site. Vets can register and to get on a hunt themselves. Landowners can bring opportunities to shoot. There's the Independence Fund that's available, and Action Track Chair has their own 501c3 where there are scholarships available or funding available to get a chair on your own.
Patrick Valdez, Freedom Hunters, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Please keep up good work and stay in touch, okay?
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now with the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Dean Reuter, author of Liberty's, co-editor, actually, of Liberty's Nemesis, is going to join us in studio later on in the hour. A brand new collection of essays on the executive overreach and the rather imperial nature of the Obama administration. Plus, Kurt Schlichter, author, columnist, panelist, occasional attorney, I think, still, is going to join us on the program later on in the hour as well. Laura Carno on Twitter, following along with the show today, says, don't forget as well, the officer in Colorado Springs who died in the Black Friday shooting was from our local campus. So there you go, another example of a campus police officer dealing with real crime. But again, in the state of New Jersey, university police officers are not apparently real police officers, at least not when it comes to the concealed carry permit that they might be eligible for after they retire. As few people as possible exercising their right to keep and bear arms, that's the goal. Actually, the goal is zero people, but you'll narrow down, they will try to narrow down the scope of the Second Amendment, how you exercise your right to keep and bear arms, right along with who can exercise that right to keep and bear arms. Now, if you believe, as I do, that self-defense is a human right, you might find this attitude more than a little objectionable, which is why you push for laws that actually acknowledge the right of self-defense. That sounds like a pretty good segue for our hero of the day today, does it not? Sponsored by AdCorp Defense. This comes from the Press Enterprise in California. Alex Groves reporting, a 92-year-old San Jacinto man shot at a man who used an axe on the 92-year-old's front door back on January 31st. The incident reported to Riverside County Sheriff's deputies shortly after 11 o'clock in the morning. Deputies say the homeowner, who lives on Chase Street there in San Jacinto, heard the would-be invader, believed to be in his 20s or 30s, attempting to break down the door with an axe. As the 92-year-old approached the door with a handgun, the suspect shattered a window and tried to climb through, prompting the homeowner to fire a round. Sheriff's officials say it doesn't appear the suspect was struck, but he did immediately flee the scene, leaving behind the axe and other items. Now, Alex Grove actually had a follow-up to this story, and good for Alex Grove and good for the Press Enterprise for not just treating this as a local crime brief, right? Two paragraphs and you're on your way. Alex Groves went back and talked to this 92-year-old man, Joseph Millspaugh. Grove says he often struggles with tasks like finding the right key to open his doors. He often needs people to repeat themselves when talking, but you wouldn't know it from the way that he handled a recent attempted break-in at his home. The 92-year-old World War II veteran sprang to action Sunday morning, firing one round at a man who had been attempting to enter his home by using an axe. Mills Paul said it was early Sunday. He heard a loud banging coming from the door to his garage. He said he went to investigate the source of the noise, but not before first grabbing his Smith & Wesson 1911 45 caliber handgun. He said, "Something told me you better get some backup before you have to head back that way." After grabbing his gun, Millspaugh heard glass shatter from a nearby room. He said, "I didn't know what to expect with all the broken glass, and all of a sudden there's this face." Alex Groves, right? The face belonged to the same man. Sheriff's officials say also tried to break down Millspaugh's door. The man attempted to crawl inside, and as he did so, Millspaugh quickly thought of a plan. "All this time I'm squeezing the trigger," he said, "and I thought, hey, I can't pull the trigger because he's outdoors, I'm indoors. I couldn't claim that as bodily harm." So the 92-year-old fired a shot to the would-be homeowner's or would-be home invader's right side, scaring him and causing him to take off quickly. The Press Enterprise says the near-home invasion has become both an example of bravery and a cautionary tale to other residents in the neighborhood. Manuel DeMello, who's lived by Mr. Millspaugh for 22 years, says he's glad that his neighbor wasn't hurt. He said it could have been a lot worse, especially if the guy with the axe had gotten inside the house. The scenario might have played out quite differently. As for Mr. Millspaugh, he said, "I always kept my gun locked in the closet. I'm going to be keeping it out now," he said. Well, there in Riverside County, I don't believe that they have the law on the books that they do in Los Angeles County that could put Mr. Millspaugh behind bars if he is found to have that firearm out but not on his person. Because that's the standard in L.A. Unless it's on your person or immediately under your control, lock it up, or you, the legal gun owner, are a criminal. I'm sure the violent criminals are following that ordinance, don't you think? Well, again, Joseph Millspaugh of San Jacinto, California, 92 years old, exercising his right to self-defense, and today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day comes from Fox 13 in Memphis, Tennessee. Two men robbed by a suspect posing as the driver of an Uber vehicle. Yeah. Happened about 4 o'clock in the morning. The victims were leaving the Pony nightclub. They were waiting on an Uber. Police report states that a man in an older model Mercedes drove up to give him a ride. But things took a turn for the worse when he drove them to a nearby motel, pulled out a gun, and robbed them. Ham Smythe is the chairman of Premier Transportation. He says there's a gypsy aspect to this whole thing. People can get out there in a vehicle and just ride around and see somebody who needs a ride and give them a ride. And in those cases, you have no idea who's driving you. If it's Uber, the vehicle's not identified, so you don't know. Should be noted, by the way, that Ham Smythe is the chairman of Premier Transportation, which is a competitor to Uber. And if you use Uber, and I don't anymore because Uber does not allow the lawful concealed carrying of firearms in their vehicle by either driver or passenger. But if you do use the Uber, you see a picture of the driver. You get the license plate of the car. You get the description of the car that will be coming to pick you up. Now, it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you're leaving a nightclub. Maybe you're not checking the driver's or the license plate with the plate that's coming up on your app. But you should. Not even, I wouldn't even say even at 4 o'clock in the morning. Especially at 4 o'clock in the morning as you're leaving a nightclub. Yes, you should be checking these things. Suspect. Described as being a light-skinned black male with a goatee, wearing a beanie and a dark hoodie. Memphis police said in the report he fits the description of a suspect in a robbery 2 hours earlier where the suspect managed to take $100 cash, a cell phone, and a credit card from the two victims of the pony. So a repeat offender in a couple of hours there in Memphis, Tennessee. Today's deal of the day. And our good guy of the day from ABC 15 in Phoenix, Arizona. You know, most of the time our good guy stories focus on men and women in law enforcement or first responders, EMTs, but those who are currently on the job. They may be off duty, but they're on the job. ABC 15 in Phoenix, though, has the story of a retired Phoenix police officer who still stepped up and went above and beyond the call of duty. Christopher Gentis is a retired Phoenix police lieutenant. And it was Tuesday of this week. He said he saw smoke and flames coming from a house there across Ahwatukee Drive. And he said, I looked over the wall and I saw this window opening and I saw her there, her being an 84-year-old woman. Christopher Jenna said, I asked if she could get out and she says, I can't move. And I jumped the wall and I ran over. He said, I then grabbed her under her arms and I dragged her through the windowsill. All the smoke in the house just started pouring out over us and I dragged her out. The flames eventually resulted in a partial roof collapse. Damage to the home was pretty severe. Phoenix Fire spokeswoman Ardell DeLees said, we have a true hero here tonight. The fact that he went in there with her is just very valiant. Christopher Jennings said it was just autopilot. He said, humans taking care of humans, doing the right thing, taking care of business. He said, I've been involved with fires before. He said, I'm glad I was there at the right time. It was all timing. Well, it wasn't all timing. Because a big part of it was actually action. Right? It was not coming to the conclusion of, well, I'm sure the fire department will be there soon. It was not coming to the conclusion of, I'm sure she's okay. She's opened the window. I'm sure she can get out. It was the act of saying, I'm going to put one foot in front of the other as quickly as possible. I'm going to help her. Now, he can say it was autopilot, but I don't think it was. Or if it was for him, it's certainly not autopilot for everyone. Because there wasn't, it sounds like, a crowd of people gathered around that window, each one jostling each other to try to get that woman out of her burning home. Sounds like Christopher Gentis was there by himself helping that woman. And so for that, Christopher Gentis, retired Phoenix police lieutenant, thank you, sir, for being one of the many good guys out there. All right, still to come on the program this afternoon, Dean Reuter, co-editor of the new book, Liberty's Nemesis, is going to join us. We have been talking about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision dealing with the Maryland Firearm Safety Act. NRA ILA's Chris Cox with a statement on the decision by the Fourth Circuit, calling it an important victory for the Second Amendment. He says, Maryland's ban on commonly owned firearms and magazines clearly violates our fundamental individual right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. The highest level of judicial scrutiny should apply when governments try to restrict our Second Amendment freedoms. That is indeed what the majority opinion said in the Fourth Circuit. It is not what the dissenting opinion by Judge Robert King had to say. Again, the dissent says, listen, let's be clear. These guns aren't protected by the Second Amendment. These are incredibly unusual and dangerous firearms. These are guns that are used on the battlefields of war. They shouldn't be illegal. There's no reason why people should have a right to own and possess these firearms. And it was a fairly poorly written decision. I got to say, as somebody, again, I'm not an attorney. I don't even play one on TV. But I do read a lot of these dissents and majority opinions, regardless of, by the way, how they're decided. And so I've seen enough of the arguments to know that this was really not a good one. He writes, the dissenting judge does. He says, this is not after saying, of course, that these guns don't fall under the scope of the Second Amendment. Clearly, they're not covered by the individual right to keep your arms. He then says, later on in his decision, that is not to say that it's easy to answer the question of whether the assault weapons prohibited by Maryland's Firearms Safety Act are protected under the Second Amendment. Oh, because it kind of sounds like you said they're not. He said the Supreme Court recently declined to expound on these issues when it denied certiorari in the Seventh Circuit's Friedman case. See Friedman versus the City of Highland Park. That's the Illinois case. Judge King, writing his dissent, says other of the federal courts of appeals have considered bans similar to Maryland's, discussed the complexity of the issue of Second Amendment coverage, and ultimately assumed but not decided that constitutional protection may be afforded to, quote-unquote, assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. The dissenting judge says the district court likewise resolved to assume without deciding that the Firearm Safety Act, quote, places some burden on the Second Amendment right. But he says that we may not decide today whether these guns that are banned under the Firearm Safety Act actually are protected by the Second Amendment, even though he's made it clear that he doesn't think that they are. He says they don't even need to reach that point. He says we can assume that they're protected, and we can still rule that the Firearm Safety Act is hunky-dory because it passes constitutional muster under the highest appropriate level of scrutiny. In other words, the dissenting judge says, listen, don't hold these gun control laws to the highest standard of judicial review. All right, intermediate scrutiny, that vague, broad middle ground, that's what we should look at when we're considering whether or not these laws infringe on the rights of law-abiding Maryland residents. The judge says, notably, not a single court of appeals has ever, until now, deemed strict scrutiny to be applicable to a firearms regulation along the lines of the Firearm Safety Act. He said, indeed, in the wake of Heller, only the Sixth Circuit has applied strict scrutiny to any firearms regulation. He says, employ no more than intermediate scrutiny in our constitutional analysis of the Firearm Safety Act is not only counseled by decisions of other courts of appeals, it is also entirely consistent with binding precedent. Puzzlingly, though, the dissenting judge says, the panel majority deems itself compelled by the Supreme Court's decisions in Heller and McDonald versus the City of Chicago, as well as our own post-Heller decisions, to apply strict scrutiny. And the judge isn't sure why that is the case. The judge says, while our post-Heller decisions don't compel an application of strict scrutiny to each and every restriction on the right of self-defense in the home. Judge King wrote the Masciandaro case, for instance, noted that, quote, any law that would burden the fundamental core right of self-defense in the home by a law-abiding citizen would be subject to strict scrutiny. But the Woolard case observed that, quote, restrictions on the right to arm oneself at home necessitate the application of strict scrutiny. Actually, however, though, he says Masciandaro did not note it, merely assumed that any law that would burden the fundamental core right of self-defense in the home by a law-abiding citizen would be subject to strict scrutiny. And the judge says Woolard didn't actually observe it, simply described the plaintiff's contention that the right to arm oneself in public is on equal footing with the right to arm oneself at home, necessitating that we apply strict scrutiny in our review of an outside-the-home regulation. Trying to make the case that in these cases where strict scrutiny has been applied, that it wasn't actually really applied. It was assumed in one case, and it was implied in another. But they never came right out and said, we are considering this under strict scrutiny grounds, even though they did consider it under strict scrutiny grounds. As I said, I've read a lot of opinions in which gun control laws were upheld, in which gun control laws were thrown out. In this case, again, in which the appellate court says to the trial court, go back, retry this case. Here's the standard of review that you need to use. But this dissent by Judge King really does seem like a lot of sour grapes rationalizations and relies on an awful lot of weak assertions about what semi-automatic rifles really are. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Dean Reuter talking about the new book, Liberty's Nemesis. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year. Beginning the first Wednesday in March, we're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing. So somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations, an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how do folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's a 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And, Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right. So you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group, Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do, and thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Kurt Schlichter going to join us a little bit later on in the program, but right now I want to welcome to the program one of the editors of the brand-new book coming out actually February the 9th, The Unchecked Expansion of the State, Liberty's Nemesis, a collection of essays and writing, and this is just a fantastic book. It is absolutely fascinating. Dean Reuter is with us on the program. Dean, how you doing today, sir?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much for having me on, Cam.
Oh, absolutely. Well, listen, I got this book in the mail a couple of weeks ago, started reading this, and immediately one of the things that I noticed is, you know, this is a collection of essays and writings on a common theme, the unchecked expansion of the state. But this is really, I think, one of the first places where you can get an idea of the scope of this expansion because of the writers and the topics that you're talking about. I mean, everything from the Second Amendment to freedom of speech on campus and due process rights, the IRS scandal and more. I guess maybe the biggest question, the first question I have for you, Dean, is how much did you have to leave out? Can we expect a second volume of this? Because there is so much here. But I wonder if we're not just scratching the surface.
A little bit of that. I mean, that was one of the concerns. When I told my friends and colleagues I was working on a book about the growth and breadth of the federal government, where it was overreaching, my follow-up line was a joke. It's going to be a 10-volume set. And you make you make a very good point. So the way we dealt with that was try to get experts at the highest ranks of government. These are people who have operated in every branch of government, some still in government, some in state government as well, to talk about those areas of the law that they knew best. And you mentioned some of those subject areas. But we also got folks to talk about some of the thematics that you see in government, some things that cut across several different agencies. And that way we're sort of taking a big picture look as well as dicing these agencies. And it turns out that the book really could be a roadmap for a friendly president for a road forward trying to get us back to the Constitution.
Okay, so let's talk about where we went astray. And you write about this in your introduction to Liberty's Nemesis. This is not something that has occurred simply with the election of Barack Obama to the presidency. I mean, we're really talking about a shift in how Washington sees itself and how Americans see the role of the federal government going back 100 years or more now, right?
That's very true. It's people would like to say this is all an invention of the modern era, but things really began to go astray during the era of Woodrow Wilson. Just over 100 years ago, the federal government started to get incrementally large. Woodrow Wilson made a decision that Congress was unable to administer the government, and he thought his ideology drove him to the conclusion that the federal government would be best administered, most efficiently administered, by learned experts in agencies. So he began to create these agencies with these learned experts who were deliberately insulated from politics, which really means insulated from accountability. So it's really antithetical. The whole structure is antithetical to the founders' view of the Constitution. And it began with Woodrow Wilson. Franklin Roosevelt sort of expanded it exponentially, and then again Lyndon Johnson expanded it further till today we have what's really sort of an administrative sprawl. There's one agency, ACUS, that's the Administrative Conference of the United States, who's sort of responsible for helping oversee agencies and administering them, making sure they're efficient. That organization tells us they don't even know how many federal agencies there are. That's how much things have gotten out of hand. What we do know is that in the Code of Federal Regulations, there are 80,000 pages of regulations. And there are other ways that agencies can touch and rule our lives and reduce our liberty, not just through formal regulations, but through informal guidance, guidelines, advisory letters, free advice they give to regulated communities. So it's not just the federal regulations, which far outstrip the laws passed by Congress. So you begin to realize who's exercising the true power in the Congress, in the country, rather.
Absolutely. And it's amazing that the agency that is in charge of sort of overseeing the agencies can't tell you how many agencies and regulations that we have. I mean, that fact alone It tells you that we've gone off the rails somewhere. And is it your contention, Dean, that all of the branches of government bear some responsibility for this, that Congresses have over time abdicated some of the authority that they have under the Constitution? Presidents have taken authority that does not belong to them under the Constitution, and this is sort of the is this, I guess, in some ways, I don't want to say an organic growth of Washington, but is more than one branch of government responsible for where we are today?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you're right on the mark to ask the question. It's a thorny issue. In addition to taking 100 years to get to where we are, it's taken all three branches of government and even the sort of silent acquiescence of the states. You know, our Constitution separates power. The founders really feared the accumulation of power in any one person or groups of people. So they separated powers, and they separated it vertically between the states and the federal government. And the states over the century, the last decades, have given up power to the federal government, sometimes for short-term gains, sometimes, you know, with acquiescence. Sometimes they've opposed it, but they've not been able to oppose it effectively. So governments flowed from the people to the states up to the federal government. Then within the federal government itself, it's all slid to the administrative state. And it's done so because of Congress and because of the courts. So you see, Congress is delegating power to the agencies. Each branch of the federal government has its own powers. Each branch has a vesting clause in the Constitution which describes what it can do. There's no part of the Constitution that says that Congress can delegate its legislative authority, but that's what it's done, delegating authority to the agencies. The agencies have gladly accepted that authority. Meanwhile, the courts have sort of read out of existence what used to be called the non-delegation doctrine, a legal doctrine that said, no, the vesting clause means something, and if it means anything at all, it means that Congress cannot delegate legislative power. So it's with sort of a nod and a wink that Congress delegates power in the first instance, and then the courts allow that to happen. The courts compound the problem then when they deal with Congress, and they tend to defer to Congress as a fellow branch, a coordinate branch of government, and they also defer to agency action. So when you challenge a congressional action or when you challenge an agency action, there's a very strong presumption in a court of law that the congressional action is constitutional and that the agency action is valid.
Talking again with Dean Reuter, one of the editors of the new book, Liberty's Nemesis, The Unchecked Expansion of the State. So you said that this book, For a Friendly President, would provide a roadmap to start to correct the course. Ironically enough, is that what it's going to take, Dean, a strong executive to actually try to set things right? Action and change be directed by Congress or be directed by the courts, or is it going to take the executive branch sort of restoring that balance?
I think it's going to change a culture. It will take a change of culture that will start from the top with a president who's friendly to the Constitution. That's going to be necessary, but not in itself sufficient. The president will have to be very intent on surrendering some power, some presidential power that's operated through the administrative state. He'll also have to be very intent on appointing the right people in the administrative agencies who will surrender power, who won't exercise the power that's been given to them illicitly. But if he does that, we'll make some good progress. But that's, you know, not permanent, because when the presidency changes, another president can just reverse course yet again. That's why we need Congress as well to stop delegating power to the agencies, to take ownership for its own powers. It's convenient for Congress to be able to say, we passed a 2,000-word bill correct everything wrong with the environment. And then when the details come out at the agency level, Congress doesn't have to be responsible for it. So Congress needs to change its attitude. But the courts also need to scrutinize agency action much more closely, and they need to scrutinize congressional delegation more closely. So everybody needs to get back to the base they were on when the Constitution was written, essentially.
And, you know, what about the argument? Because obviously there are going to be people who want to oppose any sort of effort to bring us back into balance. What about those who would make that Wilsonian argument of, Dean, listen, the world really is a complicated place, and there really is no way that Congress can manage everything. We really do need this huge bureaucracy, and, you know, for all of its faults, it would be so much worse if we didn't have the bureaucratic state.
Well, there are people that make those arguments. There are also people that make an argument, which I have some sympathy for, that judges are unelected, so they should not be the ones policing the administrative state. They're just as unaccountable as the bureaucrats are. But to your first point, I'd make the argument that there are things that can be done to rein in an administrative state. It's true the world is different now than it was 100 years ago. The first line of argument is that Congress should be more modest in its goals. It should really recognize the roles of the states. I was talking to an Oklahoma state official who says, you know, we're capable of taking care of our water. It's an asset. It is a natural resource of the state. It's important to us. We're good stewards of our own natural resources. We don't need the EPA to tell us what to do. That might not be universally true across the 50 states, but I'd like to think that it is. Congress can also, they're contemplating some corrective legislation. There's something called the Scrub Act, which would, like the BRAC Commission, review major regulations that are existing now and just propose that some of them go away. There is the Sunshine Act, which would deal with a phenomenon called sue and settle, which is used as collusive lawsuits, essentially, by friendly groups suing administrative agencies to expand agency authority. There's the RAINS Act, which would require Congress to put its imprimatur on any major regulation that's passed going forward. So if an agency wants to pass a regulation with $100 million or more consequence, it doesn't go into effect until Congress puts its stamp on it and the president signs as well. So there are things that can be done short of...
All right. You know. Short of the big sweeping...
Yeah, short of reducing the federal government to what it was in the 19-teens, for example.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, that'll disappoint some of our audience, but we can always hope, right? Anyway, the book is Liberty's Nemesis, The Unchecked Expansion of the State, edited by Dean Reuter and John Yu. Again, a full complement of essays covering, again, a variety of subjects, everything from promoting small business capital formation, again, to the moves against the Second Amendment. The book comes out February the 9th from Encounter Books. Dean, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It's a real pleasure, and I'd love to have you back at some point.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, Cam.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for your time, sir. And again, the book, Liberty's Nemesis, comes out here in 5 days, as a matter of fact. Now, Kurt Schlichter, his book came out a while ago, Conservative Insurgency. If you haven't bought it, you should buy that too. You can also read Kurt for free at places like Town Hall, IJ Review. And every now and then, you know, he pops up on CNN Headline News. I don't think Don Lemon's had him back yet, but he was on Dr. Drew the last time that we spoke with Kurt. And we'll chat with Kurt again. Who knows where he'll be appearing besides NRA News Cam and Company. But I know he's going to be with us right after this quick timeout, so stick around.
Speaking with Sean Diem with GDS Global Dynamics Security. Sean, welcome to NRA News. You are doing some very interesting and novel stuff with dog training that's got some incredibly far-reaching applications with terrorism, counterterrorism, military, law enforcement. Tell us, what's it all about? What are you guys doing?
Well, we have developed a new and revolutionary behavioral science method or model and a training method that is the next generation of canine detection, of dogs finding stuff with their nose. And the implications of this are tremendous for counterterrorism, for finding bad guys, finding bomb factories, finding terrorists in a crowd. And the sensitivity of these dogs is exponentially greater than conventionally trained dogs that we're used to seeing now. For example, our dogs can consistently find 3 rounds of AK-47 ammunition on the second story of a building from 4 or 5 buildings away, off the leash, go to the the building, go up the stairs, and put their nose exactly where those three rounds of AK-47 ammunition are. What does that mean? That means that we can find the Karachi brothers in Paris. We can find, before they strike, we can find the Sarnarak brothers in Boston before the Boston bombing. We can find the Paris attackers before they attack, because this becomes an offensive, proactive asset, and it changes everything.
So, Sean, explain, how did you get where you are now with this new approach?
I started about 25 years ago and realized that the behavioral science model, the way people thought of and saw dogs and animals, and the way they believed that their brains worked, I knew that had to be wrong because it didn't work in getting them to do things, to train them. So I started in about 1990 to create a new behavioral science model and training method. And I worked extensively with biting dogs, extremely dangerous animals that if you get it wrong, people get hurt. And in that intense environment, I was able to have tremendous control over the dogs, tremendous performance, and then I moved into working with wolves extensively. And those wolves taught me a great deal about behavior, because I could see the raw, unchanged, evolved behavior of wolves. I actually lived in a house that had several wolves in the house. I don't recommend it, but it was a great experience. That enabled me to build the foundation. And then from that foundation, I was able to construct a training method and approach that works for any working application. Then in 2011, I went to bomb dog school, and within a few days, I realized that the method they were using was minimally effective. And I've been told by many conventional trainers that they believe their dogs, when odor is available, will find it about 20% of the time. And that means 80% of the time they may be walking past it. So, and I also saw on the wall of the training room there a picture of a military bomb dog handler, and I asked about him, and he had had his legs blown off with the dog right next to him. Mm. Well, that told me that this cannot be working well if the dog is not reacting in a strong way. Well, we put about 4 years into completely reinventing the method and starting from scratch, figuring out what stimulates dogs. How do we get them to indicate faster, more accurately? Our dogs will consistently indicate down to the size of a quarter where the source material is. That means explosive ordnance disposal people can find exactly where that bomb is without having to dismantle an entire wall in order to find something that's 6 inches in diameter. Our dogs narrow it down to the size of a quarter. I knew that they needed the speed. They needed the reliability. Our dogs never give a false response. They indicate almost 100% of the time. It is possible that odor is not available and they wouldn't find it because it's not emitting enough molecules for them to find. They're more versatile, and that's how we got there, was by rebuilding the method and looking at it in a primal, evolved way.
How can folks get more information about this new approach?
They should go to globaldynamicsecurity.com, globaldynamicsecurity.com. Shoot us an email. We are now looking for teaming partners, security companies, government agencies that are looking to implement a super effective counterterrorism and security asset. We're ready to work with them at globaldynamicsecurity.com.
Sean, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information, NRA News, Cam and Company. Want to welcome to the program right now Mr. Kurt Schlichter, author of Conservative Insurgency, as well as many fine writings. Kurt, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you joining us on the program. How are things in California? Screwed up as always?
Well, no, it's wonderful. I'm here at Fox Studios to go on as soon as I finish with you. And I'm going to partake of the guy who's running a barbecue stand right out front. That's free enterprise, baby. Barbecue.
Oh, that is fantastic. By the way, the cell reception in the Fox Green Room sucks, just so you know. We'll see if we can And it was, and how funny that you mentioned that's where you are, because as I was teasing your appearance in the last segment, I said the last time we had you on, you were getting ready to go on Headline News. You were going to go on a Dr. Drew show, and now you're going to go on Fox News as soon as we're done here.
I'm like the wind. I can't be tamed.
Well, I'm glad that you still have a few minutes for us here. So what have you been writing about this week?
Oh, no, I scheduled around you.
Oh, really? So you tell the Fox people, I'll be with you just as soon as we're done here with NRA News.
Boom. You got it.
Love it. Love it.
We've been doing this 3 years, 4 years?
It seems much longer than that, but
I know, right?
let's go ahead and say 4 years. So listen, while we've got you here, I want to talk about you've been writing a lot about this. John Schindler has been writing a lot about this. The latest with Hillary's email servers, the growing number of emails that the State Department will not release because the intelligence community says, listen, this is classified. Hillary's response to date has been, oh, these silly intelligence officials, Kurt, they're always overclassifying things. Let's just go ahead and release this information. There's nothing there, I'm sure, that could be harmful whatsoever. And now we're starting to see, the Inspector General of the State Department says, well, listen, it wasn't just Hillary, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, their aides had classified info go to their email account. So are we now to the point in this investigation where it's just damage control? Now it's Hillary didn't do anything that everybody else was doing, so it'd be unfair to punish her?
No, it's bald-faced lying. And it's bald-faced lying the same way the Clintons always bald-faced lie to pull their way through whatever trouble they've gotten into. I did 28 years in military. I was a colonel, had a top secret clearance. I've been a lawyer for 20 years. I can read a statute like 18 U.S.C. 1924, 793, 798, 2701. And if what's being reported in the papers is true, Kim, she's guilty of multiple felonies and misdemeanors. I mean, there's no debate. This isn't something where you can go, well, you know, you see, it's over. You don't get to choose the classification of the material that you get. And, you know, because you've ordered a minion to go on one system, get the stuff, and then type it into a non-secure system without markings, not only doesn't make it unclassified, it's a whole different set of violations. She is just bald-faced lying and asking people to it's just not hold her to the standard everyone else would be held to, because we'd be in prison if we had to do what she did. I mean, there's no question. It's not debatable.
Yeah. Well, and Ed Morrissey at Hot Air notes a sort of buried in this NBC story, there is a distinction. Quote, none of the messages were marked classified when originally sent, and none were determined to include information from the intelligence community, according to state's inspector general, as opposed to Hillary Clinton's emails, in which case we are talking about classified information that apparently did originate within the intelligence community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just nonsense. Okay, you can't have classified material wherever it comes from, however it's marked, whatever, on an unsecure system. You can't do that. You go to jail for that. Apparently, unless you're a, you know, Democrat. And in which case, that's okay. This isn't right.
You know, we were talking earlier today with Jim Garrity from National Review, and he sort of laid out three scenarios as to how this will play out over the course of this year. He said either it's unresolved, the Justice Department tries to slow walk any sort of investigation until after the election, in which case this is hanging over Hillary's head throughout the entirety of the election season, that the DOJ would decide not to prosecute, in which case, you may see FBI officials resign. You may see officials come out and start talking publicly about what they found that they thought DOJ didn't follow through with, or that, there is an investigation. There is some sort of indictment, in which case there are all kinds of other problems for Hillary Clinton. But where we are right now, Kurt, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, from a political perspective, there is no way that this is not an issue that remains with Hillary Clinton from now through Election Day.
No, it's going to stay around. But, you know, I'm not a pessimist. I don't believe for a second he's going to be because you know, the FBI will come and make recommendations, and the facts are what they are. The recommendation should be to be in a grand jury, and the Department of Justice will not do it. And after the election, Obama will pardon her. That's what's going to happen. And the message will go out loud and clear. It's for the little people. They're not for the Clintons. They're not for the Obamas. They're not for the dirty work. And that's a very, very, very dangerous message. Because I, you know, if a lot doesn't apply to everybody, pretty soon it's going to apply to nobody.
Talking again with Kurt Schlichter. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. We will let you get to your Fox News appearance. Make sure that you wave to us, will you?
I will totally wave. It's Fox Business, Deidre Bolton. Hey, countdown, baby. I'm coming.
That is fantastic
karaoke
news.
We
will do it. Karaoke at CPAC. Kurt Schlichter, thank you, buddy. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. Kurt Schlichter with us here on NRA News Cam and Company. Fox's Green Room really does have crummy cell phone reception, though, I have to say. One would think that they would have better cell phone reception there. Perhaps they don't want their guests doing other media appearances while they are there in the Fox Green Room. But we're glad that Kurt could join us on the program this afternoon. Speaking of Hillary Clinton and those classified emails, over at PJ Media, Andrew McCarthy has a piece on Hillary Clinton's assertion that these classified emails should be disclosed, right? That this was just an example of overclassification. State Department does this all the time. Nothing big here. Just go ahead and release these emails, and you'll see that there was no reason why these things should have been redacted and classified top secret in the first place. Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, says The problem with this, to salvage her reeling presidential bid, Mrs. Clinton is demanding that the intelligence community set aside its objections to the disclosure of classified information so that her emails can be released. That is, he writes, while desperately seeking the office most responsible for protecting national security, Clinton is audaciously subordinating national security to her political ambitions. McCarthy says, let's be clear about how cynical this is. Clinton's outrageous demand is theater through and through. Before she was Secretary of State for 4 years, she sat on the Senate Armed Services Committee for 6 years while the nation was at war. She knows full well that the intelligence community would never publicize the scads of national defense information she compromised over 4 years. But this is, in essence, throwing the intelligence community under the bus and trying again to obfuscate on this issue. Most Americans, myself included, don't know all of the intricacies of federal law as it relates to the dissemination of classified material, right? Because most Americans have no reason whatsoever to become learned scholars on the intricacies of the federal statute in question. We just don't. It's not really in our wheelhouse, doesn't really come up with our friends or family or at work. But now, in order to not just cover this story, but in order to consume news and information about this story, Americans have to bone up a little bit on what the law says and on what the law allows. And when it comes to the classification, who classifies this material, where and when, again, Hillary Clinton is saying, well, this was all classified after the fact. There were no markings on there, so it was fine for me to receive this email because apparently, even though the law says it doesn't have to be marked, you know if it's classified or not. The case by Hillary Clinton is to make this as confusing as possible to the American people. The NBC News report today goes a long way towards that. I might note that Hillary Clinton's daughter Chelsea had a pretty sweet gig as a correspondent there at NBC News for a while. Started out first job in television news at, I believe, $600,000 a year. Nice work if you can get it, right? Sure, everybody at NBC News started out the same way. no local television experience, no years of reporting, just walked right into NBC News and said, hi, I'd like to be a correspondent, please. Could I have $600,000 a year? And they said, of course. Of course. Come on, sit down, have a cup of coffee. Buy a Starbucks, actually, if you want. This is, again, this story by NBC News. Within the body of the story, they point out the Inspector General for the State Department saying that this classified information was classified by state. In other words, this was not classified by the intelligence community. This was classified after the fact by the State Department itself. Now, Ed Morrissey at Hot Air says that the Secretary of State has significant authority to declassify information that originates within the State Department. But the office does not have plenary authority, as some communications, such as those relating to foreign diplomatic exchanges, are classified by presidential executive order. But even the information over which Secretary of States have that authority has to be specifically declassified, not just propagated in the open under the assumption that its status has changed. Secretaries of State, he writes, and their aides have no authority to change classification on information originating in other agencies, however, which is what Hillary Clinton, again, is calling on the State Department to do, to declassify information that originated not from within the Department of State or the State Department, but from within the intelligence communities. Ed Morrissey says, compare the situations of the three secretaries of state. All three served 4 years. Powell and Rice, to a lesser extent, served at a time when states' email systems were in flux. Yet the IG can find only two instances of spillage involving Colin Powell's private email account, and none involving Secretary Rice when she was secretary. All 10 involved her aides. Ed says Hillary didn't bother getting an official State Department account, but instead hid her communications from Congress and the courts for more than 5 years to thwart legitimate constitutional oversight on the State Department. The system she owned and kept at her house was used to retain and transmit classified information on more than 1,300 occasions. And most importantly, he writes, the information that got exposed in the system was intelligence data derived from other agencies, some of which was classified at the highest levels and put sources, methods, and agents at risk. Ed says this is the story. Is nothing more than an attempt to misdirect Americans from the egregiously corrupt and likely criminal activities of Hillary Clinton in her efforts to cover up her activities at state. And again, if this was coming from the Clinton campaign, if this was being put out in terms of talking points, that'd be one thing. This is coming from NBC News, which is something else entirely. Now, that music means, unfortunately, that we are out of time for today's program. The good news is it's only Thursday, so we'll see you tomorrow live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRAnews.com, midnight Eastern on Sirius XM Patriot 125. See you then.